So you see what I'm saying? It's the Bilderberg is not just about these specific individual policies. It's about an entire plethora of policies working together towards an evil end. And that end is slavery. That end is control. That end is changing humans' attitudes that we've had over centuries now. Basically a kind of Judeo-Christian attitude of making sure that we are always giving people the benefit of the doubt, that we are always looking at the better side of people. Now the idea is zero trust, never mind zero carbon, never mind zero COVID. It's zero trust. And we don't trust anybody. Everybody is out for themselves. Everybody is avaricious, and we have to be suspicious of everyone. And so I think that is the deeper. And actually, money is very important, but it's a tool to these ends. What they're doing is they're instituting a kind of, it's the plot to cancel God. It's a plot to cancel morality. And so that's why I think there's a lot more to this than just the kind of, you know, policy, individual policy analysis makes out. There's a very deep, dark agenda here.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Friday the 26th, in fact, of May 2023. And a good Friday, isn't it? What a good Friday to have three bank holidays in 1 month. I don't know if that's ever happened before. If it has, I'm sure you'll tell me, but I doubt it. So that's most of the Mondays in this month of being holidays. Amazing. We're streaming live from the PRSC Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, anything but Google, please. As you can just hear him coughing in the background, Martin Summers is joining us too. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade psyops, and also smearing that 30 pence a pill ivermectin COVID treatment, which could have saved 60,000 British lives, according to our friend in Bath, Dr. Tess Laurie. Matt Hancock's crimes against humanity, never mind Vladimir Putin, eh? Accelerationist cults waging war on the British people now, as well as Putin. So this is what the BBC might sound like if it were free of the tentacles of the authoritarian deep state Zionist lobbies. Any of my factual errors, I'm sure Martin will be straight away calling me out and saying, well, maybe it's not the BBC, Tony. And navigating us through that forthright matrix, of course, is Martin Summers, you just heard there. We'll be looking at a lot of the problems in the world financial markets, which, of course, have nothing to do with Bilderberg, even though the people in that meeting last weekend control most of the money in the Western world, allegedly. Well, they do. I mean, just look at all of the enormous, the Goldman Sachs's and all the other people related to these enormous banks that are now, well, isn't it Rishi Sunak's one of their little children, isn't he? Oh, No, he's an elected prime minister, nothing to do with that. So maybe we can start off, Martin, and we obviously in part two we'll be actually doing a special look at the Rockefellers. We'll be dipping into Patrick Henningsen's Bilderberg special that he did, including me, although I'm not sure if we'll be hearing actually from me, but some of the other contributors were really good. A guy called Jay Dyer, fantastic. And we'll be having some interviews from the Bilderberg meeting after the break. But Martin, let's start with this: all these economic woes. There is a problem apparently with the US debt ceiling. I'm just going to look the figures up, but why is that a problem? I think, you know, for a lot of people, they're just looking at it and saying, well, why does it matter if US liabilities are more than $250 billion? Actually, no, it's more than that, isn't it? $250 trillion.
Well, there wouldn't be a problem if there wasn't a political dimension to this, which is because they've had various bills passed in the past limiting the amount of debt that the country can have, then they have to raise the debt ceiling when it exceeds the previous ceiling. And to do that, they have to get the agreement of Congress. What that leads to is that the Republican-controlled Congress will not raise the debt ceiling unless the Biden administration does X, Y, and Z, which the Biden administration probably doesn't want to do. And therefore, there's every year there is this standoff But I think there's such a lot of ill feeling in Washington at the moment between the Republicans and the Democrats. Robert Reich, the economist, was saying that they look as if they're determined not to raise the debt ceiling, then puts the government in default, which could then cause a financial crisis.
Oh, dear. Well, isn't it silly the way that I kind of get the billion and trillion mixed up? Actually, trillion is millions of millions. Yeah. So this is $250 million. The US liabilities, if they are, as they are being stated now, $250 million, does it matter?
Well, it matters in one way, and in another way, it's not really the point. The US national debt and trade deficit are structural to their role as a global empire, and without them, they wouldn't have a global empire. And so, in a sense, arguing about it is silly. Although there is obviously a point where the empire may collapse from its internal contradictions. But the Triffin dilemma, as put forward by Robert Triffin, who's another economist, is that if you want to have an empire, you've got to have all these foreign bases, which means you've got to spend a lot of money on your foreign bases. And the way they do that is by printing money. And of course, they don't have to earn anything to print the money, because the US government prints the world's reserve currency.
The point is that they've been borrowing and borrowing and borrowing, and it now looks as if, many economists are now saying the US is bankrupt, that they'll never pay it back.
Well, that's right. They never will pay it back.
And they can't pay it back.
Well, no, of course they can't, but that's not the point. I mean, when you've reached that level of debt, it's not really a question of paying it back. It's a question of managing the crisis or what you've ended up with.
Could the banks just say to the American government, right, we've had enough, we're just closing all your... In other words, that would mean that the US government would just simply cease to function, and it would have to sell off its assets, things like the Pentagon.
Well, if it came to... This is a game of chicken between the McCarthy, who's the Republican
leader. They default. Just say, well, we're not paying.
Well, but that's probably what they are going to do ultimately. And, of course, the Chinese holding, billions or trillions of dollars of US treasuries... Ultimately, they're not going to get that money, are they? Just as the Russians lost all of their foreign exchange reserves and everything that they got in foreign banks.
What would happen to China then if the US government did default?
A shock all round. The shock to the system would be to both
sides. How
would
it affect the Chinese, do you think?
Well, I mean, there could be a crash in China, which is, they've got kind of techniques for dealing with crashes. You know, they wouldn't have any ideological objection to government intervention, for example, in communist China. But on the other hand, you could see a big crash in China simultaneously with a big crash in the US would have a fairly dramatic effect on global society.
So when it's in this fragile situation, currencies can go up and down wildly. People can massively speculate. And we saw this week, didn't we, the US stock market falling after an artificial intelligence fake of an explosion at the Pentagon. I don't know if you saw this story. It was in the Times. Yeah, so, I mean, a fake photograph of an explosion near the Pentagon has sent the US stock market falling.
Well, I mean, the potential for an uncontrollable financial meltdown is definitely there.
Is this a shot across the bow to the US stock markets?
Well, there's global wars going on where people are trying to deliberately crash other people's economies. You know, I mean, we're actually in the business of trying to crash the Russian economy, would you believe? At the same time, the internal contradictions of the global capitalist system have reached an absolutely, tumultuous point. At some point, something may very well give, and it will be a very, very traumatic financial meltdown.
Okay, so these actual negotiations happening over this debt ceiling, are they just simply between Wall Street and the US Treasury?
No, it's really between the Republican leadership in the Congress and the Democrats in the White House. And,
the banks don't get involved at all?
Well, the banks are.
The banks fund
the whole thing. I mean, they control both political parties. So, in that sense,
is just a political head-to-head, really, rather than between the lenders and the borrowers.
Well, it's a political head-to-head because the Republicans will use the power they have to veto rising the debt ceiling as a way of trying to get Biden to do what they want him to do. And in actual fact, Biden is quite a right-wing Democrat, and he's not that bothered about making the cuts to Social Security and so on that they will demand. What they do is what they call feeding the beast in the US, whereby the right wing runs up debts on spending on military stuff, which of course is huge. And the big bulk of US government spending is on military stuff and sending, you know, bombs to the Ukraine. And then they say, because we've got the big deficit, we'll have to cut back on things like Medicaid and Social Security payments. And that's because they spent all the money on weaponry.
Well, in the meantime, the Russians are over in the Middle East convincing countries to accept the BRICS currency. Russia is advancing in its mission to gain new allies and destabilise the US dollar. Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexei Overchuk confirmed the administration is seeking partners and quickening the pace for the BRICS currency. According to the Deputy Prime Minister, if more countries accept the soon-to-be-released BRICS currency, more damage could be implicated to the US dollar. The demand and supply for a new BRICS currency could send the US dollar on a path of decline. Actually, it's already on a path of decline. But anyway, Overchuk revealed that Russia's looking to strengthen its ties, particularly with oil-rich Islamic nations from the Middle East. Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, UAE have all shown interest to join BRICS.
Yeah, I mean, there's clearly an epoch-making confrontation developing between the developing world led by Russia and China and the Western imperialist world led by the United States. Two different visions of the future, two different ways of doing business. And the problem for the US is it's going to be very traumatic to adjust to being a one pole in a multipolar world, because they've got used to the idea that they dominate everything and that's what should happen.
But of course the British had to chew on this, didn't they, after World War II? We did reasonably well, didn't we? And most of our colonies were given up rather than too much fought over after World War II, weren't they?
Well, it was a bit more problematic than that. But at the same time, of course, what we did
do... I'm just looking, for example, at Yemen, where we had Kevin Carr, who was in the army over there, looking at the casualties. It was in the tens when the British were fighting the Yemenis back in the 1960s. Yeah. Nothing like the war that's been going on in the last few years.
The point is, it's what Kwame Nkrumah called neo-colonialism. So countries become independent on paper, but they still owe money to the City of London and they still get told what to do.
Well, that's what seems to happen, isn't it?
That's what seems to happen all over the place.
And particularly if there is a leader such as someone like Patrice Lumumba that emerges who really knows the score when it comes to international finance, they just assassinate them.
Well, that's right. I mean, Lumumba had been a civil servant, but I mean, he wasn't really a financial person. But nevertheless, you know, I mean, this has been the pattern all along. We've grudgingly withdrawn from direct rule over countries like Sudan in 1956, for example, because General Nasser wouldn't let us stay there. But all of these countries have been absorbed into the international system as debtor countries to the Western financial system, particularly the City of London and Wall Street. And that continues to dominate the destiny of developing countries. So in a sense, nothing has changed. And of course, much of the really brutal stuff has been done in the last two decades. Invasions and destructions of Iraq, Syria, Libya, Afghanistan. That's all been done in very recent history. It's not something that used to happen 100 years ago. The rest of the world sees us as red in tooth and claw, we are.
So as the US looks a more and more shaky prospect for an investment in the dollar too, people are moving their investments out of the dollar. I mean, those that have got money to invest into things like gold and silver and things like Bitcoin too.
Well, that is going on to some extent, yes. I mean, and the new currency that the BRICS are trying to develop will have a relationship both to gold, oil, and maybe other commodities. But the dollar system is quite robust in one sense, in that because they can print as much as they want, it gives them great flexibility. Like, they don't really have to worry about how much debt they've got because they can just print the money, although the Republicans bellyache about it because they want to try and cut things like Social Security. But I think it's more for the medium to the long term that they've got to worry. In the short run, a big financial crisis often leads to people piling into the dollar as a safe haven. So it's the currencies of the developing world which are going to be clobbered, and they are being clobbered because of the rise in interest rates by the Federal Reserve. So the developing world is now being put on the rack and told that they've got to repay increasingly unpayable debts in dollars. And what Hudson and others are recommending is just don't pay. Crash the Western banking system and throw your lot in with the bricks. And of course that is, you know, a potential game changer.
So can you tell us about, just to wind this discussion up, how is this going to affect most of us that don't have money to invest in these things?
Well, I mean, we all start...
How's it like to... I mean, if the dollar does go down, how's it going to affect the pound? How's it going to affect listeners?
Well, it's what may happen is it won't just be the dollar that goes down, it's also the pound is weak. I mean, the pound has been consistently weakest ever since.
It's coming down to near a euro, isn't it? It's coming closer and closer.
That's right.
In a way, this is something I've always found quite fascinating about the way that these currencies work around the world. For a long time, the dollar was way, way above what it was compared to the pound. The same with the euro. This whole idea of what they call parity, where a euro is the same as a pound or a dollar is the same as a pound, this seems to be somehow almost esoterically connected to who's really in charge. The City of London's days are numbered.
Well, it's it. I mean, don't forget, before 1972, currencies were traded very, there was a very, very controlled foreign currency exchanges and exchange controls and, the value of currencies was set by administrators rather than by the market. What you've got now is day-to-day buying and selling of currencies far more than is actually necessary for any kind of trade. So it's essentially speculative. And that leads to big speculative swings, which can destabilize entire societies. I think the most likely outcome here is that there is going to be a major financial event which will affect everybody simultaneously, although places like Russia may be able to protect themselves because they are self-sufficient.
Don't these things usually happen on sort of Friday night and everything has to be sort of sorted out by the time of Friday? Maybe a stock exchange will close on the Friday and then it has to be sorted out over the weekend and everyone is crossing their fingers as the markets open on the Monday.
Well, yes, it might be that sort of financial crisis, or it may be a major political sort of military crisis, which then, the outbreak of the First World War, all the stock markets in Europe collapsed and the governments had to take over what stock markets used to do. I could conceive of a very similar situation developing whereby the globalized financial system just fries itself in a great big electrical short circuit. And then what comes after that is very hard to predict.
Well, it's fascinating, I think, the way that this does affect what we do. I mean, I was just talking there about, if the US dollar goes down, does that mean that the America is bankrupt and they have to sell off the Pentagon? I mean, it might sound ridiculous, but it's not, because there is this nation-state bankruptcy interview that I did at the last Bilderberg conference I went to in 2016 in Dresden, which is Bilderberg Exposed in Dresden, one of the interviews I did there with, I can't remember the name of the guy, but he was a German lawyer. And he explained that that there are contingencies for if nation states go bankrupt, for things like the police to be sold off. All these various other things have got a value and the debtors will come along. But I mean, at the end of the day, surely this is just a simple old fashioned debt trap that in the UK and America, the banks are watching these public institutions, including democratic politicians, democratic institutions, getting further and further into debt, knowing that the lender is the master over the borrower, or the borrower is servant to the lender, and this is a debt trap, simple as that. They've got them by the short and curlies.
It is, and of course governments can short circuit that by not borrowing money from private banks but by creating their own money independent of the banks and basically nationalising the money system. But they don't do that because of the political power of the banks.
The banks are just keeping an eye open for that, and anyone that does that will be, well, something might happen. They may have accidents can happen, else they will make up some other contingency.
It's just so far outside the Overton window.
There'll be a sex scandal, that sort of thing.
Well, there'll be all sorts of things. I mean, it's not just there isn't just a crisis in the financial system. Clearly there is, and there has been a major issue there since 2008. There's also a crisis in the geopolitical system, and there is a crisis in the environmental system, not just a climate change crisis, but, all sorts of systems are at breaking point.
So what should this plan B look like if the government were to regulate the banks strongly in this way that you're suggesting. What would that look like?
Well, I think you've got a pretty good idea from the works of Michael Hudson and others like him. We've got to move towards a mixed economy, which will gradually turn into a planned economy with a residual market function. That's the future, if there is going to be a future. But the possibility is that the meltdown of capitalism is such a destructive event that it'd be very difficult to organise human society on any sensible basis after all this stuff kicks in.
Well, it is. I mean, it's not a theoretical discussion we're having here, because here in Bristol City Council this week, council accountants are warning urgent actions needed to avoid bankruptcy as the cost of providing special needs education has spiralled. Bristol City Council spent millions of pounds over budget on special needs education and is now working to bring this down despite rising demand. So how can they do that? If the demand is rising, how can they make it cost less? Answer is very, very difficult, or you can't. In the last financial year, the council spent £94 million on high needs block. On the high needs block, 16 million more that was initially budgeted. Added to overspends on previous years, the council now has a total deficit of £42 million for special needs education and just 3 years to reduce this. Now, surely the city council shouldn't be facing bankruptcy. The finger should be pointed at central government, saying, well, if you want to, you know, we've got to fulfil our legal obligation to educate these special needs children. We need the money to do so.
Well, that's right. And that's what led to the shenanigans at the council, where they were trying not to accept special needs applications and telling the council officers not to open the emails from containing such applications, because they're trying to reduce the special needs budget, because they haven't got, they're obliged to by law to provide special needs support, but they haven't got a specific budget for it from the central government, so it comes out of all their other stuff. And of course, what we're really saying is special needs kids haven't got any money for them, because it's all gone to the Ukraine and to bail the banks out.
Well, hang on, but doesn't this mean that maybe the mayor won't be able to have all these nice foreign trips and these little beanos that he has for his friends?
The amounts of money we're talking about, Tony, are much bigger than any beanos a mayor might go on. Yeah, you can argue about, yes, we could, you know, we could cut down the cleaning bill or the photocopying or whatever.
Martin, his one city plan, we're already paying for a whole load of councillors that could be in that one city plan. It's not a small amount of money. He's set up these seven policy boards where his friends are brought in to make policy for the city council. So that would save several million, wouldn't it? Just like that. And we've also had all the 40 million or so poured down the drain after Bristol Energy. So I know you're in the same party as our mayor, but really this is indefensible, a lot of this spending.
Well, you may argue that, but I think you'll find that other parts of the country have got similar spending overspends on various other things.
They're going to go bankrupt too, are they?
Well, all local government is going to go bankrupt in this country. That's one of the effects of a financial crash.
Isn't that
they'll
the plan?
All go bankrupt.
But they are. I mean, what they're saying here, this is part of a plan, isn't it, to really denude local democracy. In fact, to denude democracy entirely. While the likes of Business West, the business community, are actually raking it in, and many of their members of Business West, which is a sort of chamber of commerce for this part of the world, secreting their profits away in offshore accounts.
Well, they are, and this whole process has been going on for many decades now, and it will come to a head with the collapse of all sorts of things, not just local authorities, possibly the collapse of the health service. What happened in the Soviet Union after the so-called reforms of the 1990s is that all pension payments effectively stopped, so that people couldn't get any pensions, even though they'd worked all their working lives and they didn't get any money at all to retire on. That can happen. It does happen. In developing countries, it's always been the case that any money that's collected by the government, a large proportion of it then goes straight off to the City of London to pay unpayable debts. The whole system is rotten to the core, as we all know. And, you know, local government is merely one piece of that jigsaw. It's had the central government has basically cut back the money that it gives to local government by huge amounts over the last 20 years, and local government's got more and more things loaded on it to do, like special needs is rising. There's more special needs. They're really worried about this because there's more and more need out there because family breakdown, social structures breaking down. Suddenly you find you've got all these dysregulated kids. And that is a process that's going on. But they have to be dealt with and they have to be looked after. We have to find the resources. And therefore we've got to make some economies. We could actually get rid of our armed forces, for example. When are we going to use them? We're not.
Get rid of our police?
No. We should have the we need a police force, but we don't necessarily need to bail banks out, do we? And we certainly shouldn't be sending money to the Ukraine to kill people. What good's that going to do us? How is that going to help our special needs children?
Well, at the end of the day, it's not, is it?
No.
One of the things I've been looking at this week is a headline in the Metro today about, which I picked up on the bus on the way back from the airport, is the universities, about the UK universities the government, that is to say the Home Office, is saying that universities are not allowed to issue visas for family of people who are studying Britain to come over here because many of them are not going back again, Martin. I suppose you'll be in favour of that, being an internationalist.
No, being an internationalist, Tony, doesn't mean that I'm in favour of complete freedom of movement of everybody everywhere. That's a straw man, okay? The reason why we have university students coming in from abroad. It's the only way to make the universities viable as businesses. We used to run them as public institutions. They're now businesses. British students are actually subsidised by foreign students.
Well, that's right. The universities can't get enough money from British students, so they're having to go around the world saying, look, who's got a few spare bob? Send your kids over here.
Yes, that's right. And if we do trade deals with countries outside the European Union, which is what we're trying to do, one of the demands of those countries, say India, is we want more places at your universities and we want visas for the people to bring their families over and we want them to be able to stay afterwards and send remittances back to India. That's if you want trade deals with us.
Anyway, this article is saying that actually British universities are in the immigration business rather than the teaching business.
Well, that was true. What happened at one stage was you could only come here to study in a university if it was a recognised public university. But the Tories brought in this thing. You remember they brought in private universities, which were private businesses, and they, and there was certainly true in Bristol, they were quite keen to get people in here, just as you say, as an immigration business. It was an immigration scam. But that was a Tory policy to make the market in universities freer. Yeah? Now, if we're going to have a free market in education, that means people have got to be free to go to universities wherever they want to go. That doesn't necessarily mean I don't believe in the free market, Tony. But the people who do, that's the sort of thing they're supposed to believe in. And of course, there is some advantage to Britain of having foreign students here because they are actually contributing to all sorts of things, and not least, making sure that your universities really are up to speed to produce, high tech goods and all the rest of it. I mean, there's going to be a tension around this, whichever way you approach it. Jonathan Portis, who's an economist who wrote in The Guardian, he was saying that in actual fact, Britain's immigration policy at the moment is quite successful because we're basically bringing in high qualified people, university students and the like, and that is actually good for our economy. They contribute more than they take out. And if you don't do that, you might find that the economy doesn't, in fact, fire on all cylinders, and you've got less of a cake to deliver to people.
Now, you might remember last week I spoke to Coventry journalist Chris Hewitt about Jimmy Savile and about his long-term paedophilia, as Chris reported, being arrested six times and then orders a special branch released six times before 1978. So this was very, very well known, even before the 1980s, that this guy was a paedophile, but he was protected by royal assent by MI5 and by special branch. And Chris actually went on to talk a bit about what he says about universities and foreign students, particularly Chinese students in the West Midlands.
More and more universities are seeing Chinese students as a milch cow. And I think it's a very dangerous oversight. You see, one thing I can tell you about a lot of overseas students, if they come from wealthy homes, their parents expect them to get a degree. That's why a lot of them don't work as hard as they should do. Cambridge is the only university to date that has said that overseas students who don't do the work will get chucked out. If they fail those exams, they'll be shown the door.
Yeah, I mean, there's a temptation, isn't there, for these universities just simply to be looking at the bottom line rather than academic excellence.
They've been looking at that for a very long time, I'm afraid. Warwick was the first one to sell its soul, but you've wanted a lot more. Because universities have overextended themselves financially. I mean, I'd love to know how many universities are actually getting close to being in serious financial difficulties. Universities will go bankrupt. I mean, we've got about, was it 145 universities when perhaps we only need 30?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the idea is that there's less jobs out there since the manufacturing has all collapsed.
And that's right.
So we've got to keep people in education for much longer, even if they're learning virtually nothing or they're learning nonsense.
Well, one in four graduates have never used their degrees. That's been the case for 100 plus years. But no, the theory is that I've heard this one that they're being kept in because it's keeps them off the unemployment figures. But that is a very expensive way of doing it. Now, if you want to get young people into real jobs with real training, what we should have done, which Thatcher refused to do, was to bring our training laws into line with Germany. Because I mean, this, when an apprenticeship contract is very difficult to enforce legally. You know, they could make you spend your 5 years just making the tea. But if we had German style apprenticeships for 5 years, industry would very quickly create 500,000 real jobs, not stacking supermarket shelves, and that would get a lot of people into real jobs, into real work. So when they decided to move on to another employer, they got real experience on their CV.
Well, I think there's obviously common sense behind that, but I think the problem with apprenticeship systems is in this country is that the employers prefer to piggyback on other employers doing training. They don't want to do it themselves. The German system is more rigid, and the employers are forced to do the training. And of course, don't forget that people will often go to work in the companies which have trained them. Whereas in Britain, with a more free market, free and easy philosophy, you could train somebody up in your company as an apprentice, and then they just go. Then your competitor just offers them a slightly higher salary and gets all that training for free.
Yeah, or they go abroad maybe because the actual disposable income abroad is so much more. There's a lot of people doing that.
Well,
I just want to say that was Chris Hewitt reporting there. There's a couple of other points he made there. First of all, that Warwick was the first one to sell its soul, which is interesting because we've been talking quite a bit recently about Warwick University and various things. Warwick Business School created one of the companies one of the individuals who was at Bilderberg, for example, and who runs something called Zeno Systems, this big investment company. But going back to the basics, I just managed to get that article back up again. Robert Jenricks, the Home Office Minister, he told the Commons yesterday, some universities are in the immigration business rather than the teaching and education business. Although, of course, it shouldn't be a business. Insisting that maybe that's your fault, Robert Jenrick, or your party's, insisting the new measures will reduce migration by having a tangible effect on the number of student dependents arriving in the UK. We're clamping down on these practices that will help us to bring down net migration in the medium term. And they never talk about doing it. Because, I mean, really, this is one of Rishi Sunak's pledges. And we've just heard this week 600,000 people now coming to Britain every year from abroad. Net migration, 600,000, Martin.
Well, I mean, these figures have been creeping up for many years. And,
is that good for the country?
Well, I mean, it's what globalization is. And for
or
example,
bad?
Well, I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying this is what it is. If we are going to negotiate a trade deal with India, for example, I believe that is the aspiration, one of the demands of the Indians will be you've got to open your universities to our young people. Otherwise, we're not going to open our industries to your stuff.
Is it an accident, or the Tories, or is it just a mistake? Or is it deliberate that the Conservatives are not fulfilling any of those pledges about controlling borders? It just seems to me like it's happening again and again and again. They say, oh, we're going to do it, and they don't, and they fail, and they do it again, and they fail. It's almost like they don't want to win the next general election.
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that it's actually quite difficult to do. You can say you're going to do something, and then it turns out that you can't for all sorts of reasons that you hadn't thought of. And, you know, the world economy has become significantly more globalised in the recent past, in the last 20 or 30 years. And the implication of that is large movements of people, skilled labour flows around the system. And that's what we, you know, that's what Thatcherism was all about. At the same time as being little Englandish, it was also like we've got to be open to the world and world trade and all the rest of it. And that's what that implies. So, you know, there's a big contradiction at the heart of Toryism, where they want to be little England Tories, but they also want Britain to be global Britain, open to the world and all the rest of it.
So, Ella Braverman just refused to go to the Commons to explain the figures, didn't she? She's left it to a few juniors.
Well, that's because from her point of view, it's embarrassing because they've made a big deal out of reducing immigration and then they've not been able to do it because in actual fact, it's very difficult to do. Even if you want to do it, there's all sorts of things that you've got to take into account. Like if universities have offered places to students, are you actually going to say to those universities they can't come and therefore cut into their bottom line and bankrupt them? Is that what you want?
So this is the Office for National Statistics, always a difficult one to say. And there were some people were saying that actually net migration could have gone up to 1 million. Not very good for a 2019 general election pledge to bring it down, is it? So it's going up and up all the time.
Well, if you actually look at opinion poll surveys, they suggest that people are much less stressed about immigration than they were. They're worried now about the cost of living crisis for themselves, wondering about whether somebody else is turning up in a, you know, most people who live in major cities know that there's all sorts of people around from all over the world, and people who live in less sort of cosmopolitan places, well, they don't have to mix with foreigners very much, so it's not really an issue for them.
So what's going on within the Labour Party? Well, we heard a couple of weeks ago about this film, banned now by these cowards who run, that's at you, isn't it? It's the South West Trades Union Council up in Filton, that run the Tollpuddle Festival, and they're not going to allow Jeremy Corbyn, The Big Lie, the film, to be shown. This is great. If you can get to watch, I'm just reminding people, really, if you get to watch it, they're only doing screenings of it around the country, so you have to actually go to your local town where there's going to be a screening, because they do a little chit-chat afterwards about, you know, what are we going to do, where is this going, what's happening with the Labour Party. Have you seen the film yet, Martin?
No, I haven't, although I've heard about it, obviously.
Yeah, okay, so we're going to hear now a trailer from Oh, Jeremy Corbyn, The Big Lie.
Nobody can fail to see that this was a concerted, orchestrated campaign.
Senior officials in headquarters were actually working against Labour.
He can't see what we're doing with digital spend.
So what did the Labour Party do to you?
Ruin my life politically, they tried to.
He's a dangerous, deceitful man who will do anything.
I accuse Keir Starmer, the Parliamentary Labour Party, and the right-wing bureaucrats of actually sabotaging the unique moment in history, the opportunity that we had to bring about an irreversible change in the balance of wealth and power in our country.
Could it happen again? Any time, and that's what they're really scared of.
I want to thank our Labour Party staff, who worked really hard.
So, Martin, I think that's almost at the end there, that comment. Well, it could happen, still happen within the Labour Party almost any time, and that's what they're really scared of. Another Jeremy Corbyn could emerge.
Well, I think that's the Labour Party, or Labour movement, has been an ongoing saga since its inception in the 19th century, and therefore the possibility of change exists through the Labour Party, but also therefore the very powerful forces in society determined to subvert
that. It's very much like the Kinnock and Blair years, isn't it? Loads of Labour members are just leaving in droves because they're so disillusioned with what's going on. We heard John Mann at the start of that clip. He accosted Ken Livingstone when he was going into the BBC Milbank studios to appear on Daily Politics or something. And he said, Ken, you're rewriting history. And that was to do with the Havara Agreement. It was all about looking at the role of Nazi Germany in negotiating with the Zionists back in the 1930s. And the interesting thing about that is, isn't John Mann himself the one that's trying to rewrite history? He's accusing Ken of doing exactly what he's doing.
Well, in any case, accusing people of rewriting history is pretty lame. We're constantly rewriting history. That's what history departments in universities do. They sit there and rewrite history because there's always new perspectives, new things to learn, new information that we didn't have before, and we're constantly reevaluating the past. We should constantly reevaluate the past, surely.
Well, we've got this wonderful new thing called BBC Verify that's just appeared. This apparently is a little office next to the BBC TV newsroom. I don't know if they've got access to the phone calls that are coming into the editor telling them what we're supposed to think that day and what the news priorities are from the government or maybe from the city, but particularly we know for a fact that the government put in calls to the news editor at the BBC saying we think this should be the news today. Whether or not they actually do what they're told is another question, but they're certainly if they start regularly not doing it, then they will be hoofed out of their job. That's quite certain. The BBC's got no real independence. But this woman, Mariana Spring Martin, she's been running this thing called BBC Verify. And they just launched it, literally. But it's a bit of a peculiar thing, isn't it? So, for example, we're not having the BBC verifying what was going on at the Bilderberg conference I was at last weekend. In fact, they don't even mention it anywhere on the BBC.
Well, that's right. I mean, the BBC is probably more careful in its journalism than the Tory printed press. But nevertheless, it's still very, very controlled. And it's very clear over things like Ukraine, where what are essentially psychological warfare scams are just being treated as statements of fact by the BBC.
Well, what about something as verified as something like the Bucha massacre last year by the Russians?
Well, I mean, yes, but that is the evidence for what happened there, to my mind, points rather to the SBU and the Ukrainians as carrying out that massacre. But if you talk to anybody in the mainstream, they all know that Bucha was carried out by the Russians.
I mean, it's very unlikely, isn't it? Because what happened is the Russians retreated when the Ukrainians arrived in Bucha. They discovered that there had been a massacre taking
place. No, it didn't work like that, Tony. In fact, the Russians retreated as part of an agreement with Kiev. The mayor of Bucha was on his Facebook page saying, thank goodness the Russians are gone. We're all quite safe here. And, we're quite happy to be freed by our own forces. And then 3 days later, these bodies appeared all over the centre of Bucha. How come nobody had noticed them 3 days before when the Russians were in control? And a lot of them, I think, were actually identified by the SBU, the Ukrainian secret police, as potential collaborators with the Russian forces when they came in. And collaborating can just mean accepting a packet of Pampers from them or some bottled water.
So
those people were then executed by the SBU, not by the Russians.
So what you're saying is that the BBC Verify should be examining themselves. They should be looking at the BBC's own reports. That's not likely, is it?
No,
so what's happening here is we've got a massive, massive fall away of trust of the London mass media, such as the BBC. In fact, many ways led by the BBC as the state broadcaster. And as that trust is falling away to record lows, the BBC have decided, well, we need to set up a little unit of journalists. Well, it's actually not that little. 60 journalist team it is, apparently, working for network TV and radio to counteract fake news.
Well, what's happening is because of the existence of the internet and shows like this, they feel as if they've got to try and make more of an effort to determine what they're prepared to verify as, you know, trusted information and what they're prepared to cast to the outer darkness. And that's because, frankly, we're at war and therefore we are being fed lies and propaganda, and this unit will no doubt fulfil that function quite blatantly.
So, so that's the unit. Let's have a listen now to Mariana Spring then. Introducing herself, she was born in the 1990s. She's a BBC broadcast journalist, allegedly. And here she is explaining what BBC Verify is all about.
a new brand, and we are a physical location above the newsroom in London. And the point of the team, as you said, is to verify video, to fact check, to counter disinformation, and to analyse really complex stories so we can get to the truth of what's going on. Why does this matter? Well, mistruths can cause really serious harm to society and to the people in them. And so we want to show you our workings and really help you understand how we get to the bottom of what's happening. And I'm going to give you a bit of a flavour of the kind of work that the team are doing. So we're able to look at maps to geolocate specific situations, stuff that's going on. This is just a map of central London where we are now. And this is New Broadcasting House, where I'm speaking to you from. And it's not so important perhaps for the centre of London, but it is when we're analysing war zones or what's happening in hard to reach places. And there's a story on the BBC website today. It's looking at Russian fortifications on the front lines in Ukraine, and you can read more about it there. And there are other ways that we also are able to interrogate what's going on, including on social media. I have some undercover accounts that I've set up for the BBC's Americast podcast, and we use these kinds of undercover accounts, and these are the characters that the accounts to be able to really understand polarization online and how what's happening on our social media feeds and what we're being recommended and pushed to us can affect all of us. And they don't offer us a totally exhaustive insight into what's going on, but they can help us understand just how social media works. And then there's also investigating other mistruths and the real world harm they can cause. At the moment, I'm investigating the UK's conspiracy theory movement. I'm trying to understand more about how it's evolved and intensified since the pandemic here in the UK. I'm looking at the alternative media that finds itself at the heart of this movement and a conspiracy theory newspaper that's a part of that as well. I'm looking at the way that alternative media is funded. I'm looking at its impact on local communities. I'm looking at its connections with far-right figures and also its foreign links. That's for a podcast series that will be coming out in June. It's called Mariana in Conspiracy Land, and it will be available on BBC Sounds, Radio 4, asking that question, could January the 6th or a German coup attempt like we saw there ever happen here?
So that's Mariana Spring there, Martin, explaining what this BBC Verify, a lot of public money, or at least license fee payers' money. Maybe this is why people are reluctant to spend their money on license. Basically, telling us that if you didn't trust what you were seeing on the BBC, Mariana Spring is going to convince you that it's true.
Well, I mean, this is information warfare, isn't it? This is what this is. It's all very well to say that we're going to get to the bottom of stories and we're going to tell you the truth. But the whole trope of these people are conspiracy theorists, we are not. Whereas in actual fact, it's quite possible that the conspiracy theorists are the journalists, and it's the BBC that are conspiracy theorists.
I wonder
it's just a term of abuse, isn't it?
Well, yes, and it is also, it muddies the waters, because some of these conspiracies are true and some are false. But this term, conspiracy theory, maybe she should do a report into the origins of that.
Well, this is what's lacking, isn't it? Is this wider perspective? As you and I know, Tony, the term conspiracy theory was thought up by the CIA as a way of discrediting people asking questions about the assassination of JFK.
That's right. Like Mark Lane, for example, who was a very famous lawyer in the United States, who was getting quite close to the fact. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen, that the CIA were behind killing the American president. So
that's just a conspiracy theory.
Of course. So as people got close to it, so this CIA term, and it's now the actual document where this is suggested in the Central Intelligence Agency, was published, wasn't it, under the US Freedom of Information Act?
That's right. So in actual fact, those who've done their research know where the term comes from. I wonder if this lady has done that research. I very much doubt it. She's using a lazy trope, conspiracy theory, to label things that she doesn't agree with. And of course, she's right. There's all sorts of rubbish on the internet. You've got, caveat emptor, let the buyer beware.
She didn't talk there about, for example, the BBC's news coverage saying that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Well, indeed. So in other words, this is the establishment creating an establishment narrative to underline establishment perspectives on the way the world works. So no doubt we will find the situation where people who critique the war in the Ukraine are all outed as secret Putin agents and all the rest of it. It's old, tired stuff. But it gets wheeled out in every war confrontation that we've had through history, and this is just the latest iteration of it, isn't it?
Well, it certainly seems to be. And in the meantime, I wonder, you know, to what extent the BBC are covering the fact that Britain is becoming rat-infested. A rat map of the UK has revealed the worst rodent infestations across the country. Well, I can actually remember the day and the news story. This would be about 15 years ago. Maybe it was just not long actually after we started, so maybe 12 years ago, Martin, we started doing this programme. That Bristol City Council closed its department, which was devoted to pest infestation and to stopping that across the city. And surprise, surprise, Britain has got a horrific rodent infestation problem now. Would you like to guess which parts of the country are worse for rat infestations at the moment?
Well, I imagine it may be the inner cities, but I don't know.
It certainly is cities, absolutely right. The worst at the top of the list is the city and county of Swansea. Then you've got Southwark in London. Of course, the rats probably like the fact that they're near the River Thames, and they do actually swim around quite a bit, rats, don't they, in sewers and things like that. Then there's Birmingham City Council, Liverpool, Glasgow, Sunderland, Wigan, North Lanarkshire, the London Borough of Lambeth, and at 10 is Nottingham City Council. So mostly, basically, northern former industrial towns.
Yeah, well, this kind of thing is the destruction of the social infrastructure, isn't it? I mean, the fact that we've got privatised water companies who run the sewers, that possibly has some implications for the rat population,
well, so
doesn't it?
Infestations have soared up to 618 a day nationally. So 618 people saying, help, 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 we've got an infestation of rats. And, of course, the local authority now said, well, tough, you're going to have to pay for someone to come in and sort it out yourself. Although, of course, it is worth calling your local authority, because there may be some duties on them to do rat, whatever you call it, de-infest you. And one area of London has seen its rat population explode with a whopping 90% increase over just a year. Many other UK cities are also suffering rampant pest problems. A total of, well, it's roughly 250,000 residential rat infestations dealt with by local authorities last year. That marks a significant 12% rise in all call-outs since 2020. So this is about the infrastructure basically just being left to fall apart, isn't it? And the basic services that we used to pay for through our council tax and through the rates are no longer existent, really.
Well, the philosophy presumably is that if you're wealthy enough, you will sort out your own rat problem at your own expense. But it's a bit like, you know, pandemics. If you just leave it to individuals to deal with things, then some will, some won't. And the social problem as a whole isn't dealable with as a business, those who've got the money will be motivated to spend the money to get rid of the rats. They may or they may not, but the rats are a problem not just for the people who've got them, but for everybody else, because they breed and they spread.
Yes, well, time now to turn to our latest instalment. We had a little bit last week about pesticides with Georgina Downs, but the next instalment, as I said at the beginning of the year, we're going to be running through this hopefully before the middle of the year. It's part 6 of 8 now of this interview that I did, and I've done a much better quality copy of that available now up on YouTube and BitChute of Mark Purdy talking about organophosphate pesticides. An interview recorded, he's an organic farmer, recorded back in 2000. And, of course, we always thought of King Charles as a great organic farmer. Only thing is, he's just sacked his organic farm manager up at Highgrove, which is rather a strange thing to do without any explanation. So, I mean, imagine there's some sort of compensation for the poor guy, but maybe he just doesn't want to let him have any livestock anymore. He's a very successful organic livestock farmer at King Charles's Highgrove estate. But getting back to Mark Purdy and 2000, this section looks at Mark Purdy's legal and personal battle against the pesticide industry, particularly ICI and their Phosmet organophosphate chemical, which he believes was responsible for both BSE and CJD, that is the human version of it, and his legal and personal battle against these firms and against the pesticide lobby. This is what he has to say.
In 1984, my own organic farm I got a visit from a ministry lady one morning, and she said, you've got to treat. And I just, my gut feeling was I'm not treating with a substance I knew was derived from a military nerve gas. So the upshot was a High Court case, a judicial review, which to my surprise, I won. And I didn't have to treat my cows. And we managed to win on a terminological flaw in the Animal Diseases Act, where it transpired that the ministry had been acting totally illegally on every farm where they'd been forcing use of these organophosphate types of chemicals, whether it was for sheep dip or for the warble fly treatment, which were both compulsory measures in the UK. Because in the Animal Diseases Act, it said that the ministry were only empowered to force treatment with a vaccine or a serum. And we argued in the High Court that they were neither using a vaccine or a serum. An organophosphate was a chemical dressing. Therefore, this quashed the whole, that part of the Animal Diseases Act. This was a compulsory order. And it, should it be proved that organophosphates even played a role in the cause of the BSE epidemic, the financial damages against the government would be sufficient, according to my MP, to actually break the whole economy of the country. I mean, look what asbestosis did and with the Lloyds effect. And I think this is the reason why the government have, perhaps privately, they've mounted a very effective campaign to discredit me and my sort of kudos. And this has been mounted on clearly on quite a lot of levels to try and dissuade particularly the media. A lot of the editors at the media have been approached by MAF. There have been meetings that have largely concentrated on my particular theory, where senior science editors from all the newspapers have been informed that my work is completely absolute rubbish. And they do this by misrepresenting my work to the editors, because I'm not there, I'm not present, I'm unable to put it right and say, no, this is not my theory, you are knocking down my theory on a misrepresented version of my theory, you know. And because I'm absent, it tends to win the day, and the editors of the newspapers, which is the so-called democratic voice of our country, they're fed this complete rubbish and they believe it. I think with the government and the chemical industry, there seems to be a very, that they're dealing with BSE in a very suspicious way. It's sort of very insidious. A lot of awfully sort of bizarre, strange things have happened at certain times, which this has happened all over the world, that suggests that they're extremely worried about something about BSE getting out, something that they're obviously well aware. For instance, my solicitor, who, this could be total coincidence, of course, but several people, professional people who've been involved with me, have actually died in car accidents, in all of a similar type of accident. My solicitor, who was driving along a straight piece of road, he's the one who won my High Court case. He also did cases when it was in the days of fighting against the sort of nuclear industry. His car went out of control going along a straight piece of road, and it went into a wall and he was killed. This was put down to his car aquaplaning on water. My vet, who I was trying to get hold of some brain tissue from a cow that I had here that died of mad cow disease, and my vet was quoted in the Independent newspaper saying that we must test Mr. Purdy's theory to see if we can come to any conclusion. It needs testing, he said. A few days later, his car, going along a straight piece of road, went straight into the front of an oncoming lorry. The lorry driver was quoted in the local paper saying it was as though his car was magnetized into the front of my lorry. And the local papal article was headed Mystery Death Vet Riddle. Around the same time, a scientist who discovered that new variant CJD had been around for a lot longer than the government had been suggesting, he published a paper on this, and he had a brain bank at Chelmsford. He was found in February 1996, which was just before the March 1996 announcement that BSE had got into humans. His Jeep was found down an embankment, and he was found dead. He was around 40 years old. This was put down to a heart attack. Myself and family, we had experienced a catalogue of just very bizarre happenings, particularly during the second half of the 1980s, after my High Court case. Things like our once-in-a-lifetime disasters would happen every single year, you know, several times a year. Bizarre things, like our house was suddenly arsoned completely to the ground for no accountable reason. One day, just before a breakthrough newspaper article about a cow I had that broke the government's theory on BSE, it was about to appear in The Independent on Thursday morning. On the Wednesday night, our phone lines were vandalised down our drive, and we found them just, they were just cut and lying all the way down the front drive. So that muzzled me from the full-up media that you always get from this type of article, and that effectively worked very well. I've been inundated with visits from extremely strange individuals, often under the guise of being journalists or just victims of chemicals, and they seem to turn up to try and find out, they seem more interested in finding out information out of you, or disturbing your particular campaign. A lot of them behave in a kind of psychotic way, and which is quite worrying when you've got kids around. And at one stage, there was a supposed journalist visiting a whole group of us involved in the organophosphate campaign, and he actually broke one of the key campaigners' husband's hand because he did martial arts. They couldn't sue him for GBH because he was under Section 2 of the Mental Health Act at that time. And so this guy had broken out of a mental hospital, was going around all the key campaigners against organophosphates, driving their lives into absolute chaos immediately before a major decision was being made in Parliament by Gillian Shepherd as to whether to ban cheap dips or not ban. And this clearly was a very well orchestrated campaign to disturb, to muddle, confuse the key organophosphate campaigners just at a time when that they needed to pursue a coherent and forceful campaign to get Gillian Shepherd to ban these damn substances. And I can see why, what the games that the other side are playing. And they're using particularly sort of distasteful, violent, psychological intimidating techniques to keep people quiet or just make their campaign ineffective. They clearly know all about you and your personality before you arrive, because they try the trick of making you feel easy by, for instance, talking about poetry, you know, or talking about saxophone playing. They know well that I am a saxophone player and I like poetry, and they've been trained to come and make open me up by just making me feel easy, you know. And they're not very good actors, you know, you can see through them very easily. I would say it's almost certainly the chemical industries are behind it. They employ these sort of detective agencies who carry out surveillance on people such as myself, try to find out what we're up to. And then they work out how best to be very destructive, and they get particularly worried about people in a professional capacity, like if a doctor comes onto your side, then that becomes a great threat to them. The detective agency that were behind the murder of Hills and Morrell were linked to an extreme right-wing group, and I think I've come up against this same body of people shortly after I had a High Court case with the government, because similar individuals who were involved in this case, so I've been informed by good sources, have told me that they were certainly very active in the second half of the 80s. The chemical industry have been, much like in America, operating this system where they know that to win a particular battle over compensation, it's best to have someone planted on both sides of the chessboard. Then you can control the game and determine who's going to win. And certainly in this country, there are these information networks, or rather should I say disinformation networks, set up by people who are made to look very green. They pick very convincing individuals. And these people infiltrate campaigns on environmental issues. They become particularly interested when issues of compensation arise, such as the Camelford water disaster in Cornwall, where the aluminium sulfate put into the water supplies was blamed on ill health, potential for massive compensation claims. These information networks hit these types of campaigns. They're very convincing individuals. They have the gift of the gab, social skills. They get onto the platform. People think, just what we need, you know. And these individuals work with firms of lawyers that are set up to offer legal services to the victims who are seeking compensation. When sadly, these same legal firms, which seem to pop up in all these different cases, they proceed to lose every single case. And I think this is a serious problem that I think people who get involved in environmental issues and compensation claims should be aware that this kind of very dirty trick is going on, and that people who you think are your friends are in fact the enemy within. I mean, this is a danger. One can get very paranoid, and it's often hard to speak about these things, because if the other side can set you up as a paranoiac, then in a sense that's one, it's a sort of battle won in their campaign to discredit you.
So that's the voice of the late, great Mark Purdy. Died 5 years after I recorded that interview with him at his organic farm back in 2000. He died in 2005, Mark, an amazing... I mean, in a way, well, what he's saying there was prophetic, particularly to do with the pharmaceutical industry's disgusting treatment of... lobbying and disgusting treatment of animals as a result. In fact, poisoning the beef to such an extent with their organophosphate pesticides that it was actually poisoning the brains of people who were then eating that beef. And, of course, a massive potential compensation package, which would have been really damaging to ICI, who produced that FOSMAP, was avoided by rather extreme measures. So lots in that, Martin, particularly this. I mean, let's run through there, for example. He talks about the controlling the game, having people on both sides of the chessboard. This whole idea of if you see a financial and moral struggle as a game, if you start treating it as a game, and you then also start putting your pieces on the opposite side of the battle, then you're more likely to win. This is a kind of this is kind of game theory here, isn't it, really?
Well, yes. I mean, you could say that it isn't a game; it's real.
What I'm saying is, if you treat it as a game, mm-hmm. Then you can win.
What I got from him there, and I don't doubt what he's saying, is that there are forces at work who will try and frustrate the exercise of democratic will. And you've got the state itself, and we know from the inquiry into the special demonstration squad that the state itself had hundreds of infiltrators in different environmental and social groups. And then you've got the industries themselves, which have got plenty of money to pay for private enterprise versions of the same thing, which have overlap with the state. People think they live in a free society. They don't.
Well, so
those who run up against this hidden infrastructure, and I would include myself in that, you realise how pervasive it actually is.
So any of these
many people live in the delusion that none of it exists, and that anybody who says
Mariana Spring maybe will say that the 9/11 truth movement are mad people, and she will use an example, the idea that, well, they think they might be infiltrated. Well, how ridiculous.
Well, exactly. And I think the thing is that if people are involved in any kind of political struggle, they start to learn about how things work. But many people have never been involved in those kind of struggles, so they have no idea how these things work, and they just generally believe what they're told.
Mark most definitely was. He was talking there about the control of the Green movement, you know, people who are trying to come across as convincingly Green, whereas they're not. Funnily enough, we were hearing just last week from Dr. Chris Busby about exactly the same thing going on within the Green Party, where, for example, this family where you've got one of them who's a senior Green person, and her husband is some guy that's running now out of nowhere a big cancer charity, which is saying that, oh, actually cancer is not being caused by nuclear power stations and by uranium and this sort of thing. So in order to try and basically control the Green movement, being rather nervous about it. So as I say, Mark himself died in 2005, 5 years after that interview. He was actually sounding at times there quite nervous, talking about, for example, his vet and his doctor dying in car crashes.
Well, it's quite brave of him to bring that up. And, of course, the thing is about these things, and I would have similar stories, which I won't bother to relate at the moment. The thing about these things is you may suspect something, but the evidence is very difficult to gather.
Well, he said there, didn't he? He said it could be complete coincidence.
Well, that's right. But the point is, when these things happen, they're designed to be it's impossible to, they are accidents.
Difficult to figure out. Yeah, well, yeah. Actually, also, sometimes the police investigation is stalled, or some group or individuals turn up at the scene almost immediately.
Well, that's all of these things are true, Tony, and in actual fact, this is what, people might call tradecraft. This is what goes on. If you're a political activist, you know it goes on. And if you're on the other side, you know it goes on. And
in dictatorships,
in democracies, there's often so-called democracies, there's often more effort put into it. Because in dictatorships, you can just tell people what to think and what to do.
This is a bit
in democracy, you have to work on preventing things happening. And therefore, there's actually quite a lot more effort involved.
Okay, what about this idea of I thought he was my friend? This idea of people coming and kind of befriending you and pressing your buttons. It's a little bit creepy, isn't it?
See,
I mean,
listen,
this very much with, we talked a few times about this guy, Nick Land, who I was at school with. He suddenly, when it came to us going up into the sixth form, suddenly wasn't my friend anymore. This guy, I thought he was my friend. And I think this is one of those, I felt this with George Monbiot, working with him in Oxford. Then he became openly pro-nuclear. I'm thinking, hang on a minute, George, this isn't the person that you were when I was friends with you.
Yeah, but I mean, you can make specific allegations about specific people, but just think how pervasive this is. What they've got is a whole smorgasbord of techniques, including just having quiet people who sit at the back and just take note of everything, others that push themselves forward. And one of the things that's pretty clear is that they're often interested in things like membership lists and finances. Pretty obvious. If anybody involved in serious political activism knows that this is how the world works. And it's very difficult to combat because most organisations are open. Anybody can come to a meeting and things, you're trying to reach out to the general public. Unless you've got a different kind of structure which isn't open, and that then has its own disadvantages, the other side are able to do all these things.
That can have degrees of openness, can't it? So you can have a fairly closed leadership, but an open membership. Well, for example, now look, what I'm going to ask you about now is he's talking there about these private detective agencies, that sort of thing, private security companies being employed, possibly even private military companies being involved. But actually, this is an intelligence services type of thing. I'm just thinking of the Israelis particularly, and the excellent book about the Mossad, By Way of Deception, by Viktor Ostrovsky. And I think he's done a more recent one as well. But people like this, this is intelligence work. Is there any real difference between these private security companies and the intelligence services?
Well, they're in the same business. They're all in the same business, the business we're in, which is trying to analyse information and steer events.
But they're trying to push disinformation, aren't they? For example, you know, to fend off a high court case, as we were hearing last week from Georgina Downes and her successful pesticide case. Now, this could cost the industry millions or billions.
Well, that's why those industries have got a very strong vested interest in trying to sabotage those raising questions about what they do, and they've got the resources to do it. As you know, there's something that's in academia called actor network theory, and it's about how networks operate and how things are done, and you know everything has got an actual practical manifestation, you know, from an individual phone call to a meeting in a park to a big public meeting to whatever, and all of these places and interactions are part of what you might think of as a battlefield, because it certainly is one.
That battlefield's moving into the civil sphere, the public sphere. Yeah. So where do MPs figure? Are they pawns in that game?
Yeah, I mean, they are visible pawns in this wider game. And some with more power than others and all the rest of it.
They seem to stick their neck out a lot less than they did, say, 30 or 40 years ago. There were MPs that were, like Tam Diel, for example, were very outspoken about this stuff. There's nobody really like
that. Well, I mean, what the problem is that the Labour MPs like Tam Diel, the sort of maverick left-wingers, they've largely been purged from the party. So you've got the residual campaign group of Labour MPs who were, came to their...
All the tame ones are still there.
Well, that's right. But I mean, there's no secret about this. This is what the Labour Party infrastructure, you know, the establishment wing of the Labour Party, are quite open, really, about their desire to get rid of people they regard as the awkward squad.
It's not a secret. It's just not talked about. It's taboo, really. Anyway, so we're going to have a musical break now. We're coming back to chit-chat about Bilderberg and the Rockefellers.
Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. I needed a ride. loose, another runner in the night. Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner in the night. Blinded by the light, wrapped up like a douche, another runner. It's gonna make it tonight.
That's 1976 and 1977 from Manfred Mann, first of all, Blinded by the Light, followed by Hassan Isabah. That's from the Hawkwind album Quark, Strangeness and Charm from 1977. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. For those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner, on the talkradio.org.uk, streaming live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores, not Google, please. And if you want a non-Google Android store, please do go along to our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where there's a link there. And so it's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling, bringing you down to the Hashishim. This is, it's interesting, I think, to look at that song, Hassan Isabah. This guy was around 1100. He was a Muslim, supposedly, part of, well, he was a Grand Master of the Cult of the Assassins, a sort of Muslim diametrically opposite equivalent of the Templars, Martin.
Well, I think, they're a historically attested group, and they were quite influential in some respects in the Crusades, because they, you know, they killed, you know, various attempts to assassinate people that they didn't like. They were not on the mainstream of the Sunni Muslim mainstream. They were a Shia group, but they weren't a mainstream Shia group either.
Well, some would say that the Templars were not in the mainstream of Christianity at the time either. I mean, well, charging off to kill people in the Crusades.
The Templars were a recognised part of the Latin Church. So, in other words, the Pope recognised the Templars.
Were discovered to be Satanists.
Yes, I know, but that's, you know, that's another matter. They were officially part of the... There was one Christian church at that time, the Catholic Church. There were some heretics of various kinds.
Well, the Pope excommunicated the Templars, didn't he?
Well, eventually, yes, but, I mean, the assassins, named after... They were supposedly... they used to smoke hashish, that's why they're called Hashishin assassins. It's not true... It's not clear that they did, but that was their enemies who called them that, in other words. Yeah. But they were definitely a minority group within
it's
Islam.
So
they set their face against mainstream Islamic.
See, the more you look into this,
powers.
Yes, and there's all sorts of allegations, true or not, I'm not sure, that the Hashishim and the Templars were actually basically controlling the Crusades from both sides. So there were elements within both of those two major camps that were collaborating. I mean, for example, on the Fourth Crusade, when the Templars set off to the Holy Land from Europe, I mean, we had the letter of Prester John, didn't we, which was a complete con, which was saying, oh, we've got another Christian king over in India fighting against the Muslims on the other side. We need to come and help. It was just complete fabrication by the Vatican. But as they charged off on the Fourth Crusade, well, they ended up at Constantinople and decided to try and destroy the Orthodox Church. That was very convenient for the Roman Church, but it wasn't very Christian. They sacked Constantinople and left it with rivers of blood and not a single person living within, apparently.
Well, I mean, that's a kind of what you might call a potted history of the era. Obviously, there's a massive amount being written about this.
What I'm saying is, it's hypocrisy, isn't it, for these people, anyone to pretend that they're Christian. Obviously, they were being used in some other way. And I suppose at the time, Martin, they just thought, well, this is a long way away. People will never find this out. But, of course, historians did eventually.
Well, I think the way you're using the word Christian implies that Christians are a specific thing, and all
it's Christian values.
Christian
right?
values, as interpreted in modern times by yourself, if you like.
No, it's not just by me. Of course, it's not. It's things like the Sermon on the Mount, isn't it?
Well, okay. Well, you could argue that the Crusades definitely defied the Sermon on the Mount.
They did. Yeah.
But nonetheless, most of the people who participated in them believed themselves honestly to be Christians.
And they were all the elite of their day. Most of the peasants back home thought, what a bunch of idiots. I hope they go and kill themselves as they're off abroad.
No, in fact, the People's Crusade and the Children's Crusade, it was a general movement within Western Europe. The Pope originally set the Crusades off and he just basically wanted the military classes to go over there and knock hell out of the Muslims. But then loads of ordinary people decided that they were going to, leave the farm, as it were, and set off to go and do it, and they also went over there, and they were massacred by the Turks when they arrived. I mean, the history of Christianity, Islam, all of these all religious beliefs are besmirched by all this kind of bad behaviour.
Well,
so to the extent that the atheists, when they came along, said all religions are a con, etc. But of course, the atheists then proceeded to do exactly the same as the other religious believers had done before, which is persecute people who didn't agree with them.
Exactly.
So that, you know, this is the problem with human nature. We all think we're right, don't we?
Yes.
I mean, everybody thinks they're right. Otherwise, they wouldn't think it.
Choose to persuade others that maybe they're wrong, and others decide to go and chop their heads off because they are convinced they're wrong. Obviously, there's a spiritual element, a difference between one and the other. Anyway, look, let's get back to Bilderberg, because this is one of the reasons I like, you know, mentioning these historical ties, is because we've got a lot going on in the world, which does appear that various forces are being deliberately kind of collided into each other. Various, you know, large amounts of people around the world, particularly through the wars, that's brewing up in Ukraine. It's possibly a wider war. Is to set people against each other, and that's of course what was going on back in with the growth of Islam and with the Crusades and the Templars. But look, back to Bilderberg, and I met a few people down there in Lisbon who had come from different parts of the world. This guy his name's Alexander Duchatel from California, to come and cover the conference.
My name is Alexander Duchatel. I'm a journalist for Good Lion TV, producer, filmmaker, and I'm here to cover the Bilderberg meetings for the first time. I know you have been here for 30 years, so looking forward to get some pointers.
Okay, so but why are you here? Why have you decided to make the effort, and where have you come from?
I'm originally from Costa Rica. My mom is American. Right now I'm married to a Portuguese lady, so I'm living in Europe. Obviously, the New World Order and the global control agenda has been in my mind since probably the early 2000s. It's just I woke up at an early age, but I didn't take it seriously until, you could say, 4 years ago, which is the time I decided to get a more hands-on approach and do something about it.
So actually, journalism isn't really doing something. It's helping understand what it is. But, you know, how is the Bilderberg, do you think, best approach? How do we change what they're up to?
Well,
just by journalism, it's not going
to
happen, is it?
No, we need to awaken the masses. We need to get the most amount of people on our side to make them aware of what's going on, what these people agenda is preparing for us, which is nothing good, I assure you. And I think through pacifist protests, we can slowly but surely make them retreat a little bit, maybe back down, and perhaps we buy ourselves a little bit more of time.
Okay, so what do you understand about what's going on in there this weekend?
Well, I guess they have several subjects as their main themes to touch in these meetings. One of them is artificial intelligence, which I think is very definitive in how the media and how journalism is going to be shaped up in the future, especially with censorship in the internet, and now with Elon Musk supposedly saving free speech on Twitter, which is not going to happen.
Well, we've also got with AI the announcement that Alex Karp, who's in here, and Palantir, they are now in charge of targeting in Ukraine using satellites targeting the Russians. So this is getting involved into the, you know, sort of almost like a war game being controlled by AI.
Well, it seems like this war is happening the entire opposite way of what they're telling us in the mainstream media. Ukraine is not killing Russians by the troves, and Russia is not there to subjugate or colonize or exterminate the Ukrainian people. Obviously, if you voice up these opinions in the mainstream media, you will be cut out immediately. But this war, as far as I can see, is a sham. It's more part of the same provocations, inflation, just keeping the fear alive in people.
So what sort of vision? Do you have a vision, alternative vision to the Bilderbergs?
Well, I'd say that with these people, the only vision is to prevent that they have such centralized power and stronghold in our countries. Because obviously 120 people making decisions for the next year for what the global agenda will be, it's not going to be good for most of us.
Well, what they say is that this is just an informal conversation, and it's quite important to have those conversations without every word you're saying being recorded and transmitted on the press.
Well, and it's also like they do it for a show, because they could very well do this in their private homes. They're all friends. They're all pals behind the scenes. We know this. It seems like this is more of a formality, and I'd say more of the same method of the revelation, in which they're supposed to tell us something to be sort of a karmic cleansing kind of operation, you know?
Okay, so there is a big relationship going on between big business and politics. Mm-hmm. Inside there.
Yes, and of course we have Big Pharma, Albert Bourla, and people like that. Peter Thiel, the former...
So it's the Pfizer guy, the boss.
Yes, the Pfizer guy that claims he never got the shot. He doesn't need it. His kids don't need it. And we have other people involved in AI and payment processors, like Peter Thiel, the former owner of PayPal. And people involved with DeepMind, you know, and all kinds of artificial intelligence shenanigans.
So for those of the people who've not come across this before, how would you describe what it is that brings everyone together in there?
Well, I think this goes way deeper than just a business camaraderie, you know, how could you say, networking. These people are bound together by bloodlines. And it has been this way for centuries, if not millennia. It's not, nobody is put into a position or to be able to be elected in a position of power that is not previously chosen.
Well, hang on, because you've got Henry Kissinger is just turning 100 next week.
Yes.
Taking over from him as the Bilderberg boss seems to be Eric Schmidt, the founder of Google. So they're not connected by blood. They're people who just have a very similar idea about power.
Well, yes, and of course there's the usual...
So far as we know.
Yeah, as far as we know, but there's also puppeteers and the puppets. So obviously some of these people are just there as the front man and to get all the flack and the attention away from the main conspirators.
So how do people find your service, your webcast? Are they in English?
Yes, it's everything in English. We have a streaming service. It's called goodlion.tv. We started.
Can you spell it?
Good Lion is GoodLion.com. We have over 400 original productions, and we started this journalistic enterprise 2 years ago.
So give us an idea of what other documentaries you've got.
Well, we published the very first long documentary exposing the mRNA vaccines called Vaccine Genocide back in June 2021, when there was almost no real data available. We have also done pro-life films exposing Planned Parenthood, abortion, celebrity murders such as Anthony Bourdain, Kate Spade, Chris Cornell, things like that. Right now we're covering the murder of Michael Hutchins, which seems to be very involved with the Calaveras Mafia, and Bob Geldof.
Right. But Bill Gates is not in there either, apparently.
They have their own messengers here. We cover all things, past, present, and future, and so we like to diversify.
Okay, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tony.
So that's Alexander de Châtel, originally from Costa Rica, then California, now in Portugal. He's saying all sorts in there, Martin. I don't know, but I think this bloodline idea I'm not at all keen on, because quite a lot of the powerful in Bilderberg are not in any way, as well as we can tell, blood-related. But he is absolutely surely spot on the way that he's talking about COVID, because we know, don't we, that many of the Bilderbergers were involved at the in COVID. Actually, it was WikiSpooks that pointed that out. He's saying there that, you know, maybe we can, you know, get more people to wake up to the way the world really works. So can you just give us your take on how Bilderberg operates? Because, you know, my basic take is, well, this is in the NATO countries. Increasingly since World War II, Bilderberg have influenced who our politicians are.
Well, I mean, obviously, I've not done as much detailed research into Bilderberg as you've done, Tony, so I've only got my own limited impressions about
and
it.
And it's this dichotomy between it being a private and a public meeting. You've got nearly 25 European politicians.
I think this is the real issue. If it was just a private meeting for bosses of various kinds, including intelligence chiefs and CEOs.
Public employees?
I think the issue has got to be, public employees, you know, like heads of intelligence services are in theory public employees, and the politicians. The politicians are paid representatives of the population. And if they go to a meeting, we ought to know at least the gist of what they've been discussing. You know, it's a matter of transparency, isn't it? So I think the big question mark over Bilderberg is the role of the politicians in it. We couldn't stop them having meetings of a private kind if they were just private organisations. But the politicians are there supposedly on behalf of the general public. But of course they're not there on behalf of the general public. They're being suborned by these private cliques. And I think that's obviously what's going on there.
It's a bit of a whiff of fascism here. It's corporatism, isn't it? The idea that these big companies, banks, etc., that mostly tax dodging big organisations around the world, like your Amazons, etc., they are actually beginning to call the shots now.
Yeah, but I mean, the original fascist corporatism was the integration of the existing big business elites into the fascist state in Italy and the Nazi state in Germany. This corporatism is supranational and is and it's very changeable. Corporations can change their stripes and to spots and spots to stripes. So, you know, the oil companies become the biggest pushers of the green agenda, for example, and they're able to mutate how they present themselves. The corporatists within the original fascist structures had to be in line with government policy, either Mussolini's or Hitler's. The corporations now have liberated themselves from being in line with anybody's particular policy, although, of course, they tend to operate through the United States as the hegemon. And with vassals like Britain in tow.
Well, one of the major figures there, of course, is NATO. We have Jens Stoltenberg, all the most recent, the Secretary General of NATO. He's got his number two commander in Europe as well there. This one, an actual military commander rather than just Secretary General of NATO. As well as, of course, the Swedish. I'm not sure if it's it's the Danish Prime Minister. But anyway, I mean, there's several European Prime Ministers, both the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister of Holland, for example. This is rather worrying, isn't it? Because one of the things that we found out, and we only figured this out sort of as the conference is closing, people who were there, is that a photograph of someone going into the meeting was taken of Sweden's military civil servant who's in charge of the accession to NATO in Sweden. So Sweden is about to join NATO, supposedly, although there's been a few problems with that. The Turks saying, no, we're not having it because of the burning of the Quran in Stockholm. This guy's in the Bilderberg conference, but he's not on the official list. So this is the thing that's rather worrying, is that they're asking us to trust this list that they issue of 120 participants, and yet they've forgotten to put on that list the chief negotiator for the Swedish accession to NATO.
Well, if you remember back in the past, they didn't give out any lists of the participants at all, and they even denied
they
existed.
They did, to be fair. Those lists did exist. They were sent to the press with a little note at the top saying not for publication. And one of the jobs I did back in the day in the 1990s was get these lists and put them up on the internet.
Yeah, I mean, the detail of who goes and what they're talking about is clearly of interest given the crisis conjuncture that we're in.
But it's military, this. This is military stuff,
isn't it? Of course, I mean, I imagine most of what they were discussing was war with Russia. Let's not kid ourselves. AI is a more speculative thing.
But that's involved in the war with Russia.
Of course it is. It's all related.
Through Palantir, through Alex Karp, who's sitting in
there. It's all related.
But this is the idea that you can just switch on a computer and it will fight the Russians for you and kill them.
Yes. Both sides are...
This is happening right now.
Both sides are developing high-tech weaponry which does exactly that. But if you remember, Elon Musk gave his Starlink system, I think it was, to the Ukrainians to spy on the Russians, and then he withdrew from that rather hurriedly as it suddenly became clear to him that if he was going to do that, the Russians might just shoot it down. which of course they can and may well do going forward. There's all sorts of escalation ladders that could be initiated now because of the, you know, the refusal of the West to come to terms with the reality of what's happened.
So, yeah, so anyway, whether Sweden is going to join NATO or not, it's been very sympathetic for quite a while. On the Saturday of the Bilderberg meeting, as everyone was still there, I mean, it's mainly the Friday and the Saturday, it seems, and they head off on the Sunday. Many of them arrive, for example, the steering committee arrive on the Thursday, I guess, to have a kind of group. There's, I think it's around about 12 people from the NATO countries on the steering committee. Down at the in central Lisbon, because the Pestana Palace Hotel is up on a hill, I suppose about maybe 2 miles away from the centre of Lisbon, which is an absolutely beautiful area of parkland right next to the major river there, and a lot of old sort of touristy places, but a lovely great big park. And in the middle of the park was a demonstration where there was a mixture of English speakers and Portuguese speakers.
Desde a Austrália para aqui hoje, como várias pessoas que vieram de vários países, só para estar aqui hoje. E vocês, vocês moram aqui em Lisboa e moram no Rio Ondo. Metam o ego no cu!
My name is Monica Smith. I'm from Australia. And the reason I'm here is that Bilderberg Club are hosting their annual meeting in Lisbon, Portugal. And I don't agree with a group of 150 people making decisions for the entire world. I think that we didn't ask for them to do that, and we didn't elect them. And I don't want whatever they're planning and talking about in their fancy rooms and their fancy hotels, I don't want what they're talking about to affect Australia. So I'm here to show them that we won't accept whatever they want to do.
Well, the Bilderberg is really a NATO country's thing, not Australian.
Well, it seems like from COVID, we learned that there is a group of people obviously orchestrating everything, because the same thing that happened in Australia and New Zealand and America and Canada is all the same in England, Europe, etc. So there's obviously a group of people making decisions, and I think they're a big part of that. They might not be the only part of it, but they're part of it.
So what's been going on in Australia that's got you politicised, your blood boiling?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say, yeah, okay. Well, I was in Victoria and we had the longest lockdowns in the whole world, actually, and so I was part of the anti-lockdown movement. The media has called it, I would say, pro-freedom, but whatever. And so we, because of all the lockdowns, we really grew a very big freedom movement around this, and I'd say it's one of the best freedom movements in the world because of what we went through. And I just happened to find myself being a poster girl for the anti-lockdown, and so the media attacked me and everything, and then I promoted a protest, and I was arrested and put in jail for 22 days just for promoting a protest, which is funny because they wanted to shut me up, but it did the opposite because it gave me a platform to talk about, because before that no one wants to talk to a random girl in Australia, but now, oh, you went to prison for 22 days and now everyone wants to talk to me. So that's pretty much where it all comes from.
Okay, so give us your experience of the lockdowns over there, because a lot of people are saying, well, they had to do something. I mean, people were dying from this virus.
Yeah, well, I believe that if you are afraid, if you have a bad immune system and things like that, you need to protect yourself, of course. But it was a 99.85% survival rate. We know that now, especially for people under 40 or, you know, 25. So especially children, they should never have been locked out of school. This actually really affected their socializing and all that sort of thing. So, yes, I understand some people were scared. And if they are, they should have stayed home. But they shouldn't force healthy young people to stay home because of them. It makes no sense. It's never made sense. Asymptomatic never made sense either, but I'm not a doctor. I'm not going to go into that. But
well, one of the things that worries me is the increasing vaccinations of children, especially when they're way below the age to actually consent to it themselves. So the state is pressurising parents to have sometimes, you know, up to 15 vaccinations for kids up to 3-4 years old. This is something that maybe in their later life they might say, well, I want to de-inject this stuff.
Well, look, My mum, I'm 35 now, my mum was way ahead of the game and she never vaccinated any of us. So I don't have one vaccination and I really feel blessed for that. So I'm not saying that all the vaccinations are bad necessarily, but I am glad that I'm not vaccinated. I went to Africa with no vaccinations and look, I'm still alive. So I'm really glad my mum was like that. But I think that actually it's interesting, with the COVID vaccine, they've actually created anti-vaxxers who would not have been so beforehand, because because they pushed it down our throat, yeah, and we lost our jobs and all this sort of thing, people started to wonder, hang on, why are they censoring debate, forcing us to do it, and then slandering anyone who speaks against it? There's something fishy here. And so a lot of people then started looking at all the other vaccinations, and now they don't want any of them. So the bad thing about that is, if there is actually a virus and there is a cure that is in the form of a vaccine, these people aren't going to take it because they just don't trust any vaccines. So yeah,
most people just kind of want to get on with their lives. They're far too busy to look into all this stuff. If people don't do anything, where are we going to be at in, say, 10 years' time?
Well, it really depends on what they do. It depends on what the globalists do and what the Bilderberg Club do, because we, unfortunately, we don't have the money and the power and the influence that they have. So we kind of have to react to them in some respect. So if they try to bring in the digital currency or the currency or the digital ID or another pandemic or the global change, climate change agenda, the 15-minute cities, these sorts of things, if it's when I believe that we can't actually do anything directly against them right now. We're not powerful enough. But when they try to implement new things, we can push back. Like with COVID, we actually pushed back really, really well. We don't know how bad it would have been if there wasn't a pushback. And we have grown a lot in the last 2 years. So I can't wait for them to try to bring in a digital ID or digital currency, because I think that our pushback is going to be huge. And I want it to hurry up. I want it to hurry up, because the quicker we get through this, the quicker our children can live a better life.
Well, it's a big question, and that is, what is NATO, the Secretary General and the main commander in Europe of NATO, doing sitting down next to the boss of Pfizer up on the hill there with 25 European politicians, all in secret, plus three prime ministers and several European commissioners, all in secret? Why Pfizer? Well, we've got the oil companies too, we've got Goldman Sachs, and NATO sitting in with these politicians.
It's obviously a conflict of interest, to say the least. It seems like maybe they're making money from each other, obviously, and they're patting each other on the back, and they must think that they're this really great people. But, you know, at the end of the day, I believe in a conscience, and I believe even if you are this powerful person, you still have a conscience. And I honestly don't think that they're happy people. And even though I've been put in jail and we are here in the sun protesting with a few hundred people, I am happy. I go to sleep at night with a conscience. They don't. Now, I don't know much about NATO and these things that you're talking about. All I know about is what's right and wrong. And they do feel like they're special and important, but they're not happy, and I'd much rather be me on the streets than them in their fancy hotel.
Okay, so how do people follow your work?
So Monica Smith is my name. I've got a website, monicasmith.com, which has all the best initiatives, and the two organisations I run is Reignite Freedom, which is global, and Reignite Democracy Australia, which is more local. But really, I'm all about community groups. So I'm doing a European tour across Europe, and I'm going to have small local events everywhere. So if you just follow monicasmith.com or any of the socials on there, you'll be able to know where I am in Europe, and you should come say hi, because I just want to create networks. I say that my European tour is I want to leave a trail of community groups in my path. So that's my focus right now.
Okay, Monica, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So that's Monica Smith there, Martin. She says herself, from random girl in Australia to doing a European tour.
Well, I mean, she's obviously entitled to her particular perspective, and interesting, but I think quite revealing when she said, I don't know much about NATO, because, of course, Bilderberg is all about NATO, not really about lockdowns.
Well, it is also about lockdowns, through Wikispooks, showing that there's 120 or so Bilderbergs involved in the key positions in lockdowns. But what about this idea of they're there to make money? A bit more to it than that.
There is more to it than that, obviously. But let's face it, the bottom line for all of these people is ka-ching. Of course,
definitely.
Is.
What about Elon Musk? You know, he wasn't at this particular meeting, apparently, but he's very regularly attended the Bilderberg conferences. We've heard from this week on the BBC are telling us Elon Musk's brain chip firm wins the US approval for human study. Wonderful. That's just today. His brain chip firm, called Neuralink, Neuralink, one word, says it's received approval from the US Food and Drugs Administration to conduct its first tests on humans. It does not have immediate plans to start recruiting participants. The idea of Neuralink is to connect digital to people's brains, apparently, and he's saying that it wants to help restore vision and mobility to people by linking brains to computers. Neuralink hopes to use its microchips to treat conditions such as paralysis and blindness and to help certain disabled people use computers and mobile technology. So it's all for the good of the disabled people. And actually, of course, Musky Boy is making an absolute fortune out of various of these big international policies, such as the climate moves towards electric cars. He's become the richest man in the world on the back of that.
Yeah. I mean, this money obviously matters to these very, very wealthy people. But it isn't just about money, it's also about power, because what money buys you is the power to, you know, enact what you want to see happening in the world. I mean, Rupert Murdoch, for example, he's got very, very pronounced reactionary political views, and the fact that he's made a load of money gives him plenty of scope to push those views on the rest of society.
Yeah, but he's also done rather a good job in exposing Peter Daszak and people like that.
Well, it wasn't him that did that. It was Fox News.
You can guarantee, I think, that Rupert Murdoch would have been involved in that story approving it for broadcast. It's the sort of thing that Murdoch likes to get involved in.
As you say, he's got a reputation of being hands-on.
Nobody else did it. Nobody else in the mass media anywhere else in the world.
And Tucker Carlson has now been sacked.
Yeah, as a result.
Yeah.
So what about the digital currency and digital ID she's talking about there? This is a bit worrying, isn't it? It's a kind of move towards slavery, particularly the idea of if you've got a digital currency. What do you make of the digital currencies?
Digital currency is something that is to be, there's got to be some serious question marks about it all. What I find about our friend from Australia is how Australian her views are. So from her point of view, it's digital currency, lockdowns, pandemics. What they're discussing in there is war with Russia. Yeah, that's what the main topic is.
But isn't also part of the discussion what we were talking about with Kees van der Peel is how to keep the people down?
Yes, and also, of course, as you know, my views on the plandemic is it is actually a biological warfare agent, and all the people that have died, either from vaccines or from the virus itself, are victims of war, because we're at war. And what happens is, to my mind, is that some of the people on the more critical fringes of the movement that we're all part of, they have a very, they live in a little bubble where what they're worried about is digital currency. What they ought to be worried about, as they are in Colombia, is, am I going to be murdered tomorrow by the police? Because that's the real struggle.
Well, people are allowed to be worried about different things in different parts of the world.
Anyway,
I just want to give her website, which is Monica Smit. It's not an easy way to spell Smit. It's not what you might expect. Monica, M-O-N-I-C-A, obviously, but then her surname is S-M-I-T. So it's monicasmit.com, one word. Also there is someone who's regularly at the Bilderberg conferences. I was kind of flippantly calling him kind of Chief Hobbit, because he's there. He does look a little bit like a hobbit, and he's quite small and with a lovely beard. It's Dan Dix.
My name's Dan Dix. I run a website called pressfortruth.ca, and I am currently in Lisbon, Portugal, to cover the annual Bilderberg conference. The reason why I think it's important to do this is because we're quite literally talking about some of the world's most powerful and influential people meeting behind closed doors, essentially discussing the fate of the world. So this is something that I think people should be privy to. There's more journalists on the inside of this building than there are currently on the outside. So that's why I think it's important to give the public a proper view of what's actually happening here. So I'm just here to document it, maybe get some discrepancies in the official participants list, and just kind of document the whole event.
Okay, so the journalists on the inside, surely they're blogging about what's going on.
Well, unfortunately, they are under something called Chatham House rules. They are under rules of very strict secrecy. On the inside, we're talking Financial Times, we're talking The Economist, we're talking The Atlantic, we're talking Bloomberg. We're talking some of the most powerful and influential media organizations who have clearly been instructed, mum is the word. And that just really adds a lot, many more questions.
Well, they put out a list, we put out an agenda, everyone knows what this is about.
Yes, well, it's only in recent years that I think they've kind of been forced to sort of hide in plain sight, if you will. They've been meeting since 1954. This idea of printing the list and being transparent is really something new. and that's because of the age of, the technology that we have, the power of our fingertips. We can now expose them with something as simple as a cell phone. You know, not long ago would take news vans and editing vans and satellite dishes and millions of dollars. We can now quite literally do with the technology we have in our fingertips.
Yeah, if you go to Bilderberg meetings, you can see a list of people who are supposed to be in there, but we had a photograph of Yuval Noah Harari, for example, turning up, as we've got a storm going around the Western media all about artificial intelligence. Funny that he should show up here.
Well, big tech is...
But he's not on the list.
Right. Well, this is why it's important to document the participants that are officially on this list, because we often do find that some people are left out. And when you find out who those key people are, you can have a better idea of what the actual topics on the agenda are. So, you know, it's great that we've already started to figure that out here. So.
Okay, so how do people follow your work, Dan?
Pressfortruth.ca is probably the best site. I've been kicked off of YouTube, but I now post to a number of platforms, Odyssey and BitChute and Rumble, and about 7 or 8 different platforms. They can all be found on pressfortruth.ca.
Okay, Dan Dix, thanks very much for joining us.
For sure.
So, Chief Hobbit Dan Dix there, doing sterling work as ever, and also, of course, being kicked off YouTube is a wonderful badge of honour, something that I've also been, has happened to me. Martin, Yuval Noah Harari, I just want to make clear, he was photographed at the airport by people photographing Bilderbergers as they were arriving. So, not actually going in and out of the meeting itself. The Swedish succession of NATO guy was photographed going into the meeting. I want to make that clear. So, would they be interested, do you think, of having a presentation of some sort by Harari? Because he's probably one of the most well-known writers in the world right now about artificial intelligence and human 2.0. The idea that humans are hackable animals does sound a little Bilderberg-y.
Well, I'm presumably he is going to Bilderberg. I mean, it's most unlikely that he's come to go for a beach holiday.
Well, no, I think he was doing some sort of public talk over the weekend as well in Lisbon. There was a lot of speculation amongst us journalists on the outside as to whether it was a coincidence that he was in Lisbon.
Well, I would imagine it's quite a reasonable inference that he went into the conference, I would have thought, because he's the sort of person that they would want to have there.
Also, the idea of, poor old Henry Kissinger. There's just one thing I must talk about, because we saw him, basically there's two, where there's a business jet airport where some of the Bilderbergers fly in and out from around the world, and there's also the main Lisbon airport, so the photographers at both. Kissinger, it was rather awful to see, actually. He was made to wait for quite a while, probably something like 15 minutes in his wheelchair, as they figured out a way to get him onto this business jet, Martin. You would have thought that someone of Kissinger's stature, they didn't really have the disabled facilities of a lift to get him up to the level of the doorway of the aircraft. So after they'd been scratching their heads about how we're going to get him into the aircraft from his wheelchair, because the wheelchair is too wide for the to go up the steps, he was actually physically carried in by a couple of people and to the jet. So, I mean, it doesn't sound to me as if the TLC for the disabled, I mean, however you might be critical of Kissinger, is all that good at these events.
Well, I mean, it's a practical problem that has to be resolved, hasn't it? I mean, obviously they've got willing workers to resolve the problem. I mean, you know, it's almost like Kissinger is almost like a zombie, isn't he? He's still there.
He's still doing his stuff.
Still there.
Yeah, as I mentioned in the previous interview, it does look as if Eric Schmidt from Google is kind of taking over from Kissinger as the big man on the steering committee, who, and I think probably Kissinger is, you know, hoping that Schmidt will carry on his work. But Eric Schmidt from Google, his job is, I mean, it really is to do with the sort of future of the internet, the future of media, that sort of thing. And obviously the control of things like YouTube, he's still got an influence at Google. But the idea of artificial intelligence as well. So this seems to be the direction that Bilderberg is going. Kissinger never really was that. He was always a kind of Secretary of State. He wrote books on nuclear war, this sort of thing. So what does the move from Kissinger to Schmidt tell you about the direction of these conferences?
Well, it's hard to draw any direct conclusions because we don't really know what they're talking about. But I think they've always wanted to cover the whole spectrum of the techniques to control society. So they've got military people there, they've got techie people in there, they've got financial people in there, and you know, there's all sorts of overlap between these different areas. You know, they're not discrete areas, they're all linked.
It's probably a good idea to look, just run through. You're saying we don't know what they're talking about, but they do issue a list, and a lot of it is. Let's just run through it. As I said last week, Ukraine's at the bottom. Well, and Charlie put me straight and said, "Well, it's just the whole thing is just alphabetical, Tony. So that's not significant that it's at the bottom." Thank you, Charlie. So we've got AI, the banking system, China, energy transition, Europe. Fiscal challenges, India, industrial policy and trade, NATO, Russia, transnational threats, Ukraine and US leadership. So, anything, I mean, that does tell us quite a bit about what they're talking about in there, doesn't it?
Yeah, and isn't it a bit of a cheat that they've got India being discussed there, but the Indians aren't even represented?
The neutrality of India. Yeah, what are we going to do about them? I mean, obviously, if they had Pakistan on, it would be probably even more controversial, because we know the CIA have been involved in toppling Imran Khan from power in Pakistan.
Well, they're not very happy about Modi in India, and they're not very happy about Erdogan potentially winning the presidential election in Turkey. So the masters of the universe do attempt to control world politics, but it's not always as easy as they think. And of course, they're only what, you know, large sections of political elites are not represented there. You know, it's not a global gathering of everybody, is it? It's NATO. And of course, NATO has just opened an office in Tokyo. That's quite logical. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization needs an office in Tokyo.
Well, Tokyo's where the G7 was being hosted, and we saw...
No, the G7 was in Hiroshima.
Oh, right, okay.
Very significant day.
At Japan, anyway. So, yes, it is, of course. It's, you know, geopolitical, that city, that's for sure. But we saw, actually, Eric Schmidt go out of this Bilderberg conference to fly over to Tokyo and then come back on Sunday.
Well, he flew over to Tokyo to go to Hiroshima, presumably.
Yeah,
to the
G7. Yeah. Yeah, so Schmidt did some sort of presentation there. He seems to be quite an important figure nowadays, doesn't he? In the G7, why?
Well, because these networks are what we've identified as the power networks ruling the Western states, you know, and therefore they network. I mean, you know, it's not that surprising. I mean, it does seem a bit, you know, I suppose it's probably very likely that somebody would go to fly all the way from Bilderberg to Hiroshima to be at both meetings. So that, you know, they may even actually talk to each other on Zoom, mightn't they?
They certainly might. Anyway, let's have a listen now to another discussion that we did the evening before last, which was organised by Patrick Henningsen on his 21st Wire. It's called the 21st Wire Forum. And I thought it was, I mean, there was a good discussion there, very good, I thought. He brought in all sorts of interesting people, including Alex Craner, who's a fairly regular appearance on our show, former hedge fund manager, and definitely not a Russophobe, quite a Russophile, actually. And, of course, Russia is in the, I mean, yeah, before we hear from Jay, can we just say something about Bilderberg and Russia, Martin? They obviously don't get on, do they?
Well, that's right. I mean, the Russian state has been excluded from Bilderberg. I mean, they're being cast into the outer darkness, and we're not allowed to play football with them anymore, even though they hosted the World Cup. And a lot of what they're going to be discussing in Bilderberg is what they're going to do about the debacle in the Ukraine, because they like to think that they control events, but in actual fact, they don't necessarily do so, because they haven't got all the cards.
I suppose the conspiracy theorists, if we are allowed to call them that, will like to think, in a way, that Bilderberg is in control. Of course, it's not.
That's right. That's right. I think that's one of the delusions that people have, that it's a sinister cabal and they control everything.
Well,
and
it is a sinister cabal, but they don't control everything.
Well, that's right. They control an awful lot of stuff, but they're not omnipotent.
Yeah. I think, well, it seems to me their main object has been to control politics within the NATO countries, and they've been pretty successful in doing that, and policy. Okay, so let's have a listen now to Jay Dyer speaking on Wednesday evening in a discussion that Patrick Henningsen organised on Twitter, which has had a few technical problems with my contribution, but eventually I managed to get there. And I put a full link to this. It's about two and a half hours, I think, altogether, on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Here's Jay Dyer talking about what he thinks is the sort of origins of the Bilderbergers and the origins of globalism.
Jay, over to you first, please.
Right, so essentially, this is the idea for a kind of inner corporate governance where the inner party is not really known to the masses or to even necessarily the outer party. Cecil Rhodes came up with the idea from studying the Jesuits. Now, it's not a Jesuit conspiracy in the sense that Jesuits control it, but he is very explicit that he really liked the idea of their structure and even incorporating kind of a cell model at times. And so he came up with the idea of 12 inner core people who would function as a kind of roundtable group, you know, pulling from Arthurian mythology. And then to the outside of that, you have what they call the Society of Helpers. And this is 1,000, 2,000 academics that are recruited into under the auspices of the civilizing of the world at that time, right? So this is British Empire period. The idea is let's recruit people to come into this, and they're recruited from Eton, Cambridge, Oxford, etc., for the purpose of, as I said, advancing the British imperial civilizational structure. However, the real designs were, according to John Ruskin and others, the sort of inner clique involved in this, was the establishment of a world Fabian Socialist Federation. So Lord Lionel Curtis writes a book called The Commonwealth of God, where he says that we're going to have to establish a kind of global federation of democracy. And eventually democracy gets dispensed with for Fabian socialism. And that's due to the influences of the Fabian socialists on Lord Milner, one of the key figures in this inner core. And so they come up with the idea of setting up what they call roundtable groups. And these are just, it's just steering committees, right? Again, using the Arthurian model. So the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which goes back to sort of the Royal Society and the idea of sending out imperial, you know, geologists and people to go out and scout for the empire and probably also to do a little bit of spying on the side. The same idea is used as a model for setting up steering committees. So whenever you hear these names of things like the Council on Foreign Relations, the Bilderberg Group, the Trilateral Commission, they're all structured on the same circles within circles model. And that's why many of the same people attend the same groups. And these are the same people, by the way, that established the British security services, right? They come out of the wartime, sure. But the real establishment of, for example, British intelligence was Lord Cecil, Lord Salisbury, right? Same guy. And he's from the same group of the, what they call the Cecil Block or the Milner Group. And the idea here was that the best way to bring America back into the sway of the British Empire, even though the British Empire is basically dying, would be to have this inner secret core governance, corporate governance, and to make alliance with the wealthiest families in the United States. That's exactly what they did. Rockefellers, Vanderbilt, J.P. Morgan, et cetera. They created essentially corporate governance. And so Chatham House, which has the rule of, you know, Chatham House rules, you don't speak about what is talked about at Chatham House, becomes the basis for the New York version of that, which is Pratt House. So Pratt House is set up. This is a lot of people from the Pilgrim Society, one of these inner Milner groups as well. And these are the same people involved in setting up the American OSS and CIA. So you can begin to see that the exact same structure of how the governance in the secret corporate model is done in the UK is literally just copied and pasted onto the US, right? And it's the same families, the same elites, the same oligarchs, and they all share the exact same view of Malthusianism, neoliberalism, technocracy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think they initially believed in technocracy. I think that's something that gained acceptance later on. You had some visionaries like H.G. Wells and Bertrand Russell, who amongst the Fabians did like this idea of technocracy. And then it kind of fell out of favor, and then it becomes more and more popular, particularly after Brzezinski writes Between Two Ages. So that's definitely the time when you can, you know, you can say this is definitely the dogma of this empire for sure. And it's what Brzezinski talks about as the American empire. It's the same thing. That's who controls the Anglosphere 100%, and they still control it. So hopefully that makes sense, and there's some kind of context to what Chatham House is, what Pratt House is, and these, I think, are the inner people who, you know, the CFR, for example, you know, they hand the policy to the politicians. This is why it doesn't matter who you elect, they're going to be doing what they're told by these people. That's why this agenda never stops. Doesn't matter how many rascals you throw out, this marches forward.
So, Jay Dyer there speaking on this Patrick Henningsen program, Martin. Do you want to just give us your idea of what he's saying there? I mean, it certainly does seem as if these modern elections don't really mean anything anymore in the West.
Well, I mean, don't forget, they never meant much in the first place. I mean, you know, this democracy has been extremely, limited throughout most of the modern era.
You don't think it's a stranglehold is getting any worse? It's just the same as it's always been.
No, it's not. It's getting worse now, but don't forget, we didn't start off with a democracy which has gradually been undermined. We've never really had one, and this is why these elite cabals are able to dominate things, because they do.
What about Cecil Rhodes? He's talking quite a bit about him.
Yes,
there.
Well, he's obviously a key
figure.
Person, yeah.
Yeah. So what was his role, do you think?
Well, I think he saw that the British Empire, you know, he wanted the British Empire to continue, but he saw the Americans.
He was around kind of at the height of the empire,
yes,
the late,
he was.
Late
yes.
1800s,
yes.
Wasn't he?
No, we're talking about the 1890s.
Died in 1900, I think.
Yeah.
And in his will, he left all these sort of plans for what he believed was going to be the British Empire spreading even further and dominating the world.
Yes, because his vision was that the British Empire would reincorporate the United States. It would ostensibly be independent.
After having infiltrated it.
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's right. But don't forget, there's huge personal linkages between elite US figures and elite British figures. I mean, you know, Churchill was married to an American. That many of the wealthy elite in England married American heiresses for their money, and then the children of those marriages became, you know, the people that go to Bilderberg today.
I wonder if these marriages aren't a bit like those sort of old feudal ones. They're not just about the money; they're also about the, well, in the feudal case, it was about land, but these surely are about power.
Well, they are. I mean, don't forget, most people marry people from their own social group. I mean, the Conservative Party, when it was a big mass party in the 1950s, people joined it to find marriage partners of their own social status. You know, I don't want to marry a boring old solicitor. I want to marry a barrister and all of that. And that's been true it's generally true that parents of wealthy families do not want their children to be marrying penniless, penniless people.
You know, it's also a way of stopping conflict in some ways. You know, if you can think, if someone's a threat to you, say a nation is a threat to you, then what better way to deal with it than to have some sort of royal intermarriage between the two countries?
Well, I mean, that was the standard practice in the Middle Ages.
What I'm saying is a similar thing may be going on today with big corporations.
Oh, well, yes. I mean, there is similarities in this.
It's a bit feudal, isn't it?
Well,
it does smell of that.
This is how elite inner groups operate. You know, they marry each other so that they've then got shared genetics in their children, all of which tends to bind them together and keep them on the straight and narrow of whatever it is they're plotting
to
do.
Well, maybe there's something to this bloodline things after all.
Well,
anyway.
I mean, there is clearly. I mean, the bloodlines idea makes sense in that. That's the way elites have always worked.
Look at the Bush family, for example.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. This is the way elites have always worked. They, you know, they control, you know, who they marriage and money and all the rest of it. But of course, the idea that this is all, you know, somehow occult and supernatural, it's actually quite straightforward.
He didn't say that.
It's straightforward.
Well, he didn't say
wealthy
that.
People no. want their sons and daughters to marry
Jay
other wealthy
certainly
people.
Didn't say anything like
they've
that.
They've always been like
he
that.
He was criticising the World Socialist Federation, the Fabian Socialists, particularly.
Well, it's obviously, as an American, he doesn't like socialism. So
well, no, it's Fabian socialism.
Fabian
he's particularly
socialism.
Picking on.
Yes, I know. But the Fabian socialists were, in actual fact, not very radical at all. I mean, you know, the Fabian socialists are presented in America as, oh my God, behind all of this corporatism, there is in fact socialism. But yeah. Fabian socialism is top down. Technocracy would be a good description of it.
Okay,
the idea that the intelligent and the wealthy should decide what happens in society.
Is that more Starmerite or Corbynite?
Well, I think Starmer is a member of the Fabian Society. Most moderate Labour MPs are.
And the Rockefeller Trilateral Commission he was. I don't know if he still is.
Yes. I mean, Starmer would openly boast of his establishment credentials. He sees it as a vote winner amongst the marginal, you know, the Tory voters he's trying to attract.
And he prefers the World Economic Forum to Westminster.
Well, that's right, because World Economic Forum, you can get
stuff
done.
He knows what side his bread is buttered.
Well, he does. In a sense, it's hardly surprising. You know, it's what you'd expect.
Yeah, well, what's happened is, I think, Starmer's been pushed as the appropriate leader for the party, which is almost certainly going to be running the UK after the next general election, simply because he does what he's told. He's getting his marching orders from the corporate side.
Yes, that's right.
And he's not really got that much interested in voters or parliament.
Well,
at all.
No, he's got to win the election. That's his interest
really that
in voters.
As it's the Tories seem to be making such a hash of things.
Yeah, but I mean that makes his job easier. But at the same time, the real problem is the general direction of travel of Western society is the wrong one.
Well,
and Starmer isn't necessarily going to be the person to change that general direction of travel.
I'm afraid
anybody who thinks that needs I have a suspension bridge to
you. Certainly have again. Anyway, managed democracy is what we're talking about here, and this is another topic that came up on our discussion, the 21st Wire Forum with Patrick Henningsen, Bilderberg, World Economic Forum, G7 and World Government. I'm not quite sure who the speaker was, but he's excellent, I think, talking about this whole idea of managed democracy, which Bilderberg represents.
Actually, the term managed democracy, it describes the West, the Western world and the neoliberal economic model perfectly. And this kind of semi-oligarchic structure that basically exists. And why am I remarking on this? I'm remarking on this because I think a lot of people in these spaces and kind of in of this mindset, and I myself generally as well, struggle with this idea like, oh, all our part, you know, we're presented with this idea and with evidence every day that our politicians are complete morons, right? They're making stupid decisions. They're saying really ridiculous things. You know, just look at Annalena Baerbock, you know, and the idiotic things that the German government is saying. Just look at Trudeau and his very cringe and embarrassing woke posturing, you know, where he's dressing up in an Indian attire and then going around lecturing other countries about LGBTQ rights or whatever. You know, they look like total idiots and they don't know what they're doing. They're mismanaging the economy. They make themselves look like total fools. So the picture that not just us, but the average person has in the West, you know, is of total mismanagement, is of total incompetence. And so I don't blame people when they think that elites are stupid, that the people in charge are idiots. They don't know what they're doing. You know, people are like, oh, look at Trump. He's a fool. He's a clown, right? But I think that what Basil and other speakers and just everyone else has been saying, the theme of the spaces is that that's not who's in charge, right? These are front men. These are front men who are there to kind of do this kabuki theater, do this distraction game, and actually divert attention away from the people who actually are in charge. I don't mean this in a kind of a conspiratorial way, but like, you know, there are real nexuses and institutions of power, like unelected institutions of power, like whether it's bankers, financiers, primarily, I think, intelligence agencies like the Five Eyes, who constantly coordinate with each other, who basically make real life decisions that politicians have either have to sign off on or have no idea that these are being made, right? Like, this is kind of common knowledge that a lot of the stuff, for example, with Operation Gladio in Italy, like, you had elected Italian governments coming in and they either weren't told at all about the secret operations that were being done by in the name of NATO by Italian intelligence services, or they would be informed after the fact and they're like, look, just sign on the dotted line, like, we're doing these secret operations, we're not going to tell you anymore. And I mean, just that just shows that there are these real people in charge behind the clowns, and they let the clowns kind of clown out and, you know, divert attention away from them, because that's like a really effective way to kind of make people disillusioned and divert, you know, the sword of Damocles, right? The person who's really in charge doesn't want the sword of Damocles, the sword of, you know, from public opinion, the sword of, you know, the consequences that they might face from mismanagement or an economic crisis, right? It's perfect. You just get some idiot like Keir Starmer or Annalena Baerbock to do your, you know, really embarrassing, dirty political work, and if the you know, the economic crisis comes in, you know, they're gone, and you've got like a whole other group of groomed politicians, you know, from the Trilateral Commission or whatever, from like the inner network, you know, that you know are controllable. They're intelligent enough to know how to present themselves, but they're not intelligent enough to necessarily know how to take the real power. And I just think that that's kind of fascinating, this idea that that we all are, the people in charge are idiots, is completely false. And I think you can see this in Ukraine. There's a lot of incompetence there, like from the Western side on Ukraine. But actually, if you think about it from a game theory perspective, from the perspective of some of an elite that is paranoid about losing power, is playing the game of global dominance, these people are prepared to take a huge risk, and they don't care that lots of people are going to die, that lots of people are going to, that the entire economies are going to crash. They don't care, right? That that's what Nord Stream is going to do, that's what inflation is going to do, destroy people's lives. If you think about it, the strategy that they're playing, the West is playing in the Ukraine, I think it will fail. But the people who are in charge, the people who are behind the clowns, making the real decisions, behind the Trudeaus, behind the Baerbocks, they are playing a very high-risk game. And I think our elites are now used to playing these high-risk poker stakes games, because they're like, okay, we have a maybe 30% chance of winning.
So I'm not sure who that participant was. This is a discussion that took place on something called, well, it's Twitter. It's a Twitter space, it's called. This is, you know, because Twitter traditionally is just a few words or a short video. This is 2.5 hours. This is the way Elon Musk has sort of moved Twitter on. But it was, I think, an excellent discussion. One of the problems is there's very little kind of reference to it. Even I had a look earlier today on Patrick Henningsen's website, and I couldn't find it up on there at all. But it's still there on Twitter, and you can have a listen to it. And I'll put a link up to the full discussion, 2.5 hours nearly of it. And my own contribution, I'll spare you that now. But what do you make of that take on this whole idea of managed democracy, Martin, which is basically theatre for the public?
Well, I mean, that's pretty accurate, isn't it? That's pretty accurate. We all know that, you know, somebody like Joe Biden isn't really in charge of the United States. There are people around Joe Biden who are in contact with the people who are really in charge, and decisions are being made. Like, you know, Biden obviously, according to Cy Hirsch, did sign off on the blowing up of the Nord Stream pipeline. Whether he still remembers that he did is another matter. But it's quite clear, obviously, to the Russian side, that the people in charge in the West aren't the ones that they supposedly to pick up the phone to talk to are not really the ones that they need to talk to. But they're very well aware of that.
So my discussion, I put in my two halfpence in that discussion, really talking about this whole concept of the Dark Enlightenment and accelerationism, saying, well, look, people are focused on Ukraine, obviously looking at Bilderberg. It's very Ukraine heavy, with a lot of military people there from NATO, you know, these people to do with the succession of NATO from the NATO countries, a sort of NATO political forum. But there is a whole load of other things in the background. You know, you've got the cost of living crisis, the economic crisis, Ukraine crisis, climate crisis, migrant crisis, trans, education in schools crisis, pesticides. We were talking about last week and a bit this week with Mark Purdy too, not to mention COVID. So I just looked at the pattern here, where all these crises are being created and most definitely promoted by the mass media, but then the solution that's being proffered to these crises is all wrong on every single one of those. You know, the idea of sending more arms, for example, to Ukraine and getting more countries to join NATO, Martin, is just going to exacerbate things. And that's the same for all of those crises, I would argue. For example, with the economy, increasing interest rates is actually going to increase inflation, not decrease it. But anyway, what do you make of this idea of the sort of multi-crises?
Well, this is clearly what's happening. The various systems at work in the world are in all simultaneously moving into crisis mode. And, you know, this is to some extent a deliberate provocation by the West in order to retain their power. The key moment was the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, and then suddenly there was a rush to the head of arrogance on the part of Western elites. I remember at the time going to a conference and talking to people, the real danger now is bourgeois triumphalism. The idea that the Soviet Union has collapsed, everything it represented was wrong, we were in the right about everything, and now we've been proved completely right, and therefore we can just do what we want with the future.
And it all turned sour, didn't it? The peace dividend went nowhere. It sounds a little bit actually like Cecil Rhodes we were talking about earlier. His great idea to, we're going to have a great big empire around the world, actually it's going to make everything better. No, it never did.
Well, I mean, the great empire around the world did emerge. It's the US empire in 1991. It's just that we don't want a great empire running the world,
well,
do
and
we?
Also marching into any country it wants and kicking them around. I think it was Jay Dyer that mentioned the Rockefellers. So anyway, a couple of weeks I've had this sort of sitting there, a few clips on the Rockefellers, and I think it's quite useful and interesting to go through these now. One I've not got here is one from the sort of university sector, but I'll be talking about that in a minute. So our first Rockefeller clip is someone who's talking about William Stevenson, who's the something called the BSC, British Security Coordination, in World War II. Anyone that's interested in this should read, and I think any students of the Second World War must read this book, A Man Called Intrepid, by a different William Stevenson. So it was two William Stevensons. One was writing about the other William Stevenson, bizarrely. I think he was a Canadian journalist writing about this spy in the Second World War. But the British Security Coordination was actually headquartered at the Rockefeller Center in New York and started up well before the beginning of the Second World War and the Americans entering it. And in fact, one of the aims was to make sure that both America and Britain stayed well ahead on the intelligence game. So it's almost as if they kind of knew the way that World War II was going to transpire, and they were going to make sure that they won it on an intelligence war before it started.
I was working at the Central Intelligence Agency, and I spoke to my boss about the fact that there's a missing chapter in the story of the origin of CIA. I said, there's a story about a man of whom nobody seems to know anything.
Although he'd always say, look, my good name's Intrepid, anywhere you are in the world, if you get locked up or you're in jail or whatever, call me and help will be on the way.
Ian Fleming said James Bond is a highly romanticized version of a true spy. The real thing is Bill Stevenson.
I didn't meet him till I'd been working for him for quite a long time. And when I was finally ushered into this large office of his in Rockefeller Center, I got quite a shock.
From the 36th floor of Rockefeller Center, New York, under the guise of British passport control, Bill Stevenson and his agents are involved in almost every aspect of intelligence work. Coding, forgery, counter-espionage, and propaganda. How did a kid from Winnipeg end up at the heart of international intrigue?
I think the genius of people who work in that, all right, espionage, and it is an art, not a science, in my judgment, is they have a ability to absorb knowledge very quickly, to gather information, analyze that information, interpret that information, and form a judgment in a way which most of us don't.
World War II was one of the most valuable military victories of modern history. A number of countries pulled together. And in that, pulling together, the pulling together of the intelligence services was critical, and Sir William's role in that is undeniable and unarguable.
Sir William Samuel Stevenson, the celebrated spy master who became an inspiration for Ian Fleming's James Bond. Some feel he's the pivotal person who helped save England and defeat Nazi Germany. In wartime, Churchill said, the truth was so precious it had to be surrounded by a bodyguard of lies. Bill Stevenson said, nothing deceives like a document.
When he walked, you know, as though he had little springs under the balls of his feet, even when he walked across his office to shake hands with you, and very pale eyes. And unlike most small men, he never stuck his head up to look at you like that. He kept his chin right in, and only his eyes, which were very, very bad, his eyes went up and looked at you. And he never raised his voice, ever.
One sensed always that one was dealing with a man of far-sighted experience and imagination.
He was not a writer, not a talker, but he was an activist, whether it was in business or intelligence.
Long before anybody else came up with it, he had this idea of a one world trading and industrializing countries.
He was a tough little bugger. You were never really conscious of size with Sir William Stevenson. So he was a bit like a Jack Russell Terrier. If you know anything about Jack Russells, they all think they're 10 foot tall, and every dog or thing they encounter think they're 10 foot tall too. So it's not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the amount of fighting the dog.
So that's all about William Stevenson there. I don't know if you what you make of it, Sir William Stevenson, sorry. Very important figure, very much a globalist, who was based at the Rockefeller Center right the way through the Second World War, running a kind of just private British, well, not private, because obviously they were working very closely with the two governments, US and British intelligence. I mean, it's all, for people who are interested, it is described very well in this book, A Man Called Intrepid. But why is what is he doing in the Rockefeller Center? Why is he in there?
Well, there's obviously a story there about why he in particular is in the Rockefeller Center. But the fact that these people have networks and organizations and plans is hard, you know, we don't know exactly what they were plotting, but we know that they were plotting.
Well, one of the things he does, literally at the very beginning of the Second World War, before the Americans were even involved, he organizes the taking of one of the Enigma machines, the coding machines from the Nazis in Poland. And one of the quite clever things they did is they blew up a truck which had one of these machines in, and they had a mock-up made, which was a blown-up Enigma machine, which was very similar to an Enigma machine. So the Nazis saw it, and they thought, oh, this one's been blown up in this explosion. What had actually really happened is they pinched the original and put this blown-up machine there for the Nazis to find. So this was happening right the way, you know, so they were reading the American codes right from the very beginning.
The American
Sorry,
codes?
The German codes. Right. Oh, did I get the Americans and the Germans mixed up? Sorry.
Well, yes. Well, you know, I mean, people are, you know, there's all sorts of popular literature about the world of spies and spying and all the rest of it. And then there's the real world of spies and spying. I mean, I didn't get very much from that clip, apart from, you know, what an amazing spy this guy was, and he's very like James Bond. It's like, well, that's all pretty, you know, there's no detail in there about anything, is there, really? And as we know, James Bond was named after James Bond, Operation James Bond, to remove Bormann from Berlin. But that doesn't sound as if any of that comes through in any of that. We're just being presented with, you know, British master spy wins World War II single-handed, as it were.
Well, I think he was an American, wasn't he?
Sir, somebody.
Well, he's been made a sir, so does that mean he's got to be British?
The point is that these people are, you know, there's an awful lot of linkage between the elites in Britain. England.
Canadian.
England.
He was a Canadian.
All right, England, as they call it. Isn't it? That's very revealing, isn't it? England. They don't mention Britain. It's England. And as we all know, England does run Britain. So it's not that inaccurate.
No. But anyway, the book is called A Man Called Intrepid. Some official historians at the Foreign Office don't think it's in any way credible, but it's absolutely brilliant if you've never read it. It's a fascinating backstory from the Second World War, and that's our first clip about the Rockefellers, because that's where this organisation was based, at the Rockefeller Center in New York, the BSC. Second clip is from Aaron Russo. Now, Aaron Russo stood for Governor of Nevada. He was a film producer, and here he is talking about Nick Rockefeller and the Council on Foreign Relations, the relationship he was basically being recruited to try and join the Council on Foreign Relations, which is this private foreign policy think tank we were hearing about from Jay Dyer earlier. And also, he discusses feminism. This interview was recorded by Alex Jones back in 2009. And Aaron Russo was dying of cancer and subsequently died as a result. But anyway, let's just listen to his take, Aaron Russo's take, on his chit-chats with Nick Rockefeller, who was trying to recruit him into their inner circle.
We remember, we were friends, and we used to go to my house a lot. We'd have dinner, we'd talk. And he'd tell me about business investments that he'd get involved in, you know, or they would help me with this business investment or that business investment. And was I interested in joining the Council on Foreign Relations? You know, I would have to get a letter to join them, but was I interested in that? And, you know, just stuff, you know, leading you on. And I used to say to him that I never really did that because that wasn't where I was coming from. You know, as much as I like you, Nick, you know, your ways and my ways, we're on the opposite side of the fence. You know, I don't believe in enslaving people, you know, and...
And he would come back with, oh, I do? Or?
Well, it would be more like, you know...
It's better for them.
Well, it's more like, you know, how do I put it? It was like, what do you care about them? What do you care about those people? What difference does it make to you? Take care of your own life. Do the best you can for you and your family. What do the rest of the people mean to you? They don't mean anything to you. They're just serfs. They're just people. You know, it was just a lack of caring, you know? And that's just not who I was. It was just sort of like cold, you know? It was just like cold, you know? And I said, what's the point of all this? You have all the money in the world you need. You have all the power you need. What's the point? You know, what's the end goal? And he said the end goal is to get everybody chipped, to control the whole society, to have the bankers, the elite people, you know, the bankers and some governor controlling the world. And I said, do all the people in the Council on Foreign Relations believe this way you do? He said, no. You know, most of them believe they're doing the right thing. A lot of them believe it's better off being socialistic. You know, we have to convince people that capitalism, that socialism is really capitalism. Because America's becoming a socialist country. It's a communist country today. Well, one of the things they told me was that he was at the house one night, and he would talk, and he started laughing. He said, Aaron, what do you think women's liberation was about? And I said, I had pretty conventional thinking about it at that point. I said, I think it's about women having the right to work, getting equal pay with men, just like they won the right to vote, you know? And he started to laugh. I said, you're an idiot. And I said, why am I an idiot? He said, let me tell you what that was about. We, the Rockefellers, funded that. We funded Women's Lib, you know? And we're the ones who got all over the newspapers and television, the Rockefeller Foundation. He says, and you want to know why? He says, there were two primary reasons. And they were, one reason was, we couldn't tax half the population before Women's Lib. And the second reason was, now we get the kids in school at an early age. We can indoctrinate the kids how to think. It breaks up the family. The kids start looking at the state as the family, as the school, as the officials, as their family, not as the parents teaching them. And so those are the two primary reasons for Women's Lib, which I thought up to that point was a noble thing. You know, when I saw their intentions behind it, where they were coming from when they created it, the thought of it, I saw the evil behind what I thought was a noble adventure. Right. Well, see, the whole thing is these people control the money, so they make all the rules. You understand? And they put whatever rules they want into effect.
So that's the voice of Aaron Russo there, speaking way back in 2009, just before he died, to Alex Jones. What do you make about his discussion about the Council on Foreign Relations, Martin, being recruited into that? And also, they're about Women's Lib. Pretty controversial, isn't it? The idea that Women's Lib was paid for by the Rockefellers in order to double the potential taxation.
Well, the Council on Foreign Relations, if he's, you know, he's being approached to be recruited, isn't he? Which is, you know, that presumably is a fairly... You know,
and that comment about what do you care about them?
Yes, all right. Well, I mean, that sounds perfectly plausible to me. The Women's Lib thing, or feminism, if you want to use a more neutral term, obviously there is going to be vested interests in pushing various things. That doesn't mean that there aren't women who are demanding things like, you know, I'd like to be able to go out to work, and when I go out to work, I want to be paid the same, as other people.
What about taking the kids off families?
Well, I mean, this is where this is the American right wing's obsession.
But he's right. I mean, they have taken kids off families.
Well, they do.
They?
Yes, we do take kids.
And this
kids.
Cost of living crisis has forced it even more.
Yes.
That, you know, actually you see less and less of your children now.
Well, that's true anyway. I mean, our society has become more commercialised in every possible way, and therefore, you know, things like, you know, long family holidays and so on become more, you know, you can't afford them if you've got no money. I think societies are actually quite complex. There are top-down attempts to try and change thinking and push certain ideas rather than other ideas. And there's also bottom-up attempts to try and change things that people don't like. And sometimes those things overlap. You know, it just depends.
Okay, a third of our clips on the Rockefellers now. Now, this is a clip from this documentary by Vera Sharav, Never Again Is Now. About the idea of never again the Holocaust, and it's her a Jewish take on what happened over during the pandemic. So here she is talking. Actually, I think what you hear is not so much of her, but quite a lot of Dr. Zev Zelenko talking about his view on the Rockefellers' influence on medicine.
I have a phrase. This time around, we're all Jewish. The Rockefellers were one of the richest families in history. They monopolized the oil, Standard Oil was their company. And they were huge proponents of eugenics. It started with the funding of Margaret Sanger's initiatives. She's the founder of Birth Control Review. She was a huge advocate for forced sterilization, abortions, and prophylactic measures, which later she was the founder of Planned Parenthood. Rockefeller was the number one financier of eugenics research for Nazi Germany, as well as in America. In 1910, slightly unrelated, but it'll show you a pattern of behavior. Rockefeller sent an army of propagandists to every single medical school in the country. And their objective was to bribe the administration of every single medical school to affect the thought patterns and prescription patterns of the new doctors that were being graduated. And away from traditional methods that had millennia of thousands of years of collective experience, to only pharmaceutical, big pharma products. By the way, at that time, all big pharma products were petroleum-based, which Standard Oil had the monopoly for petroleum. When it became obvious that petroleum-based pharmaceuticals were causing cancer, Rockefeller founded the American Cancer Society and covered up on that little phenomenon. Rockefeller owned, or was a majority owner, of IG Farben, IG Farben made Zyklon B gas. It was used to gas people in Nazi gas chambers. Jews, gypsies, Slavs, handicapped people, political prisoners. Mostly Jews, though. And Rockefeller also owns the company that makes RU486, which is the morning after abortion pill. So if you notice, everything that that family, every initiative of that family has a theme of annihilation of human beings. The reason why I pick on this one family, because now you still have the Rockefeller Foundation, and they still did their crazy research, and one of the accessories to this genocide, Dr. Rick Bright, who sabotaged President Trump's order to make hydroxychloroquine available to every American through the national stockpile of medicine, he literally sabotaged that and was fired for insubordination, now works as a director at the Rockefeller Foundation. So there is a theme. Okay? The theme is that this family and many families like them are demonic at best. They view the rest of us as a resource, an expendable resource. And useless eaters. You know, Elon Musk a year ago debuted his humanoid robots. And during that presentation, he said the following, verbatim, that these robots will replace 90% of the human workforce. Therefore, we need universal basic income. So let me tell you what that universal basic income list is. You think the degenerates that don't value life, who you as vermin, want to give away free money to useless eaters? What that universal basic income list is a future extermination list.
Well, that's the rest in peace, Zev Zelenko, Jewish doctor there. He's saying, Martin, the universal basic income. I mean, we've been basically talking about, well, I suppose, promoting this idea that everybody should be given this certain amount of money. He's saying, actually, this is potentially a future extermination list, the idea that you're dependent on this and you can just be cut off at any time, I suppose.
Well, I mean, the real problem is the underlying contradiction of capitalist development, which is that as machinery, and of course we're getting an exponential growth in productivity, supposedly, from computers and AI and so on, you push people out of work, and as you push them out of work, because you're replacing them with machinery, either incrementally or in big jumps, you then undermine the basis of the capitalist economy, which is people buying stuff, because they ain't got any money. Mm. Now, you can get round that by creating credit bubbles, which is what they've done.
It is,
but of course,
it, yeah.
When the credit bubble bursts, the fundamental contradiction returns, which is ultimately only resolved, according to traditional Marxist views, by a revolution which dispossesses the owning class and puts that means of production in the hands of society as a whole. Now, that is actually something that's definitely on the horizon, because the level of robotization, which is now being considered all over the world, including in China, really is going to be fundamentally changing people's relationship with work. Now, in actual fact, the question is who's going to control that transition, and what's the outcome going to be? And I think we need to have things like a universal basic income and other things as well, like nationalized industries and provision of free goods in order for society to progress.
Yeah, but I mean,
this
means that everyone
is the ruling
everyone
class.
Many people are going to be dependent on the money system, and as soon as that credit is switched off, you're switched off. So, just a minute. We also need to talk about the final clip on the Rockefellers. Is in a blow to all science worshippers everywhere, a German study has claimed that up to one in five scientific journal articles could be fake. This is in the FT this week. The University of Magdeburg showed that 20% of biomedical research papers had signs of being faked. And that's the final theme of our four-part Rockefeller examination this evening.
At an age when he was thinking about early retirement from a job in human resources, Nick Brown, the second of our trio, was inspired to take a master's course in psychology. and were soon debunking a published study on happiness. Now, the academic world that inspired him also appalls him.
I think there is an enormous amount of fraud that goes on, but it's very difficult to get anybody to put a formal percentage estimate on it because we can't know. We can't know whether, for example, we're only catching the people who are incompetent at doing their fraud and therefore they leave bits of wire sticking out, or whether there's a lot of people covering it up.
So now?
I'm an interfering, curtain twitching, retired busybody, really.
Who tries to expose fraud and other problems with research quality. Although he also wonders if he's a sort of vigilante or data Batman. Once a Cornell University professor came to their attention, whose big thing was influences on what we eat, like plate size. You may have heard of it. Nick and others investigated. At the latest count, I believe, 18 of the professor's papers have been retracted. Another case was research backing the drug ivermectin, a horse dewormer for COVID-19. Nick was one of those who helped reveal serious research flaws and much besides. But policing science isn't always clear-cut. Those questionable research practices, for instance, what are they and how do we judge them?
We have this euphemism, questionable research practices, which is, you know, things like having two or three goes at stopping the study to see if you've got a significant result yet, and if you haven't, then you get some more participants. Not that many studies are entirely fabricated, but I think a great many are enhanced by removing inconvenient participants. And that is, as far as I'm concerned, not a questionable practice. That is fraudulent. You ran these participants, you got these results, you can't arbitrarily exclude the data until you get the number you're looking for. I don't consider that questionable or in some way, you know, pardonable. And maybe the very first time, but there are people who are doing this, you know, for an entire career, and it's not questionable, it's fraudulent.
That's just one variety of questionable practice. There are more. Dorothy Bishop is Emeritus Professor of Developmental Neuropsychology at Oxford University, who also writes and campaigns on research quality.
With a questionable research practice, you do a study, you have genuine data, but how you analyse it is not optimal in the sense that you may be analysing it in a way that will be very likely to give some spurious result. But people often do this without intent. They don't really realise that what they're doing is inappropriate. And so people don't want to call it fraud, but they do call it questionable. A common way this is done is that somebody does a study and measures many, many things or does many different types of analysis and only reports the one or two that come out as looking statistically significant, and they make a big fuss about that as if this is the main result.
Well, I think it's a fascinating little documentary there. I don't know if you could guess that that was the BBC. It was on a few weeks ago. It was called The Truth Police, calling ivermectin a horse dewormer. I suppose that's the sort of thing we can expect from Mariana Spring, where actually it's also a human dewormer, and it's also has this serendipitous side effect of actually stopping a lot of reproduction of many viruses in the body, and it's an extremely effective cure for COVID and a very cheap one in many cases. So anyway, Martin, what do you make of that? Those different techniques they're talking about there, very simple. They didn't even mention the funding of these research projects. You won't get stuff funded if it might challenge the orthodoxy of Big Pharma.
Yeah, I think that's the obviously, I mean, obviously you'd have to listen to the whole programme to see if they did cover that. The question is always, why would people falsify results? Well, it's because for financial reasons, largely. They want research grants and so on, and they, you know, they've got to come up with the results that people want them to have. In theory, science is an arena where, you know, false stuff is propagated and then other people shoot it down. I mean, that's how it's supposed to work. There are going to be different theories, and people are going to have their pet theories, and they're going to push them, and other people are going to say, no, that's wrong, and they're going to try and dismantle it. But, of course, the elephant in the room is the funding of it all. Somebody has to fund it, and they've got vested interest in what results they want, haven't they?
William Dodd, it was, I think, that that did the fascinating talk about the way that the Carnegie Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, and other foundations were basically controlling academia through these funding these specific posts in universities from the 1950s and 60s onwards, and this was massive. And I think his study was in the 1970s, we're now at a stage where many of our universities are just simply mouthpieces for the corporate world and not doing what they're supposed to do, which is impartial, because the funding from the corporate world has taken over from the public funding, which is, you know, the public and the government is caught in this debt trap, so it can't afford to fund it anymore. Anyway, a few stories before we close. COVID conspiracy doctor. I mean, we've heard all about Tina Turner, of course, from wall to wall everywhere. But what about COVID's conspiracy doctor dies after claiming to have been poisoned? British-born Dr. Rashid Buttar, US-based, had insisted that the pandemic was politically motivated and planned. He died at the age of 57 days after claiming he'd been given a poison containing 200 times what was in the vaccine. A conspiracy theorist, they call him in the Daily Express, doctor has died just after claiming he was poisoned. A mysterious circumstances, insisting a controversial interview about his COVID pandemic disinformation that he'd been poisoned within 200 times of what was in the vaccine. Maybe we'll have a clip of that next week. He was part of a group nicknamed the Disinformation Dozen. Died suddenly on Saturday, May the 20th, at the age of 57. Reports say he was an anti-vaxxer. Oh, lovely. Thank you very much for that. Yes, he's, as millions of people are, of course, even more against vaccines after what they've seen following in the wake of Dr. Andrew Wakefield and people like that. He'd become a cult figure, apparently, although this is just the way they characterise him, amongst those opposed to the vaccine during the pandemic. He previously alleged on a CNN programme that challenged his conspiracy theories that the COVID pandemic was planned and politically motivated. Well, anyway, poor old Rashid, no longer with us. Another bit of news from the Express. Philip Schofield has admitted an affair with a young male, this morning runner, whilst married. He's left, he's gone. A couple of other things, just from Bilderberg, Martin. David Lammy, most probably the next foreign secretary, he was there, although he nearly didn't get in. So what do you make of Lammy? What's your political view of him? If he becomes foreign secretary, what can we expect?
Well, I think he's definitely angling to be a very, very pro-NATO, pro-US foreign secretary. And he's been over to the US several times to convince them that he's absolutely the sort of person that they want to be foreign secretary of Britain, which, of course, means that he's likely to be an absolute pushover for whatever wars they've got planned for us.
Well, some of our journalist friends were sending footage over of Lammy trying to get into the Bilderberg conference, and they wouldn't let him in, and then he ran off behind a bush. So that was used by Guido Fawkes. And it's a bit sick, really, that it's just the right-wing people that will have a go at the left-wing people at Bilderberg. So there's all sorts of other things that go on, but they're only interested. Guido Fawkes is only interested in what happened to David Lammy. He was hiding behind a bush. And so the Bilderberg conference people who come out to try and find him, who he was on the phone to, had to be shown where he was hiding behind a bush by some of us photographers. That's where he is. You know, you can go and find him around behind that bush there. Poor old David Lammy, in very lack of courage at standing there, and he didn't want to be photographed. Finally, Martin, bizarre thing, but Dennis Hassibis from Google DeepMind, he's a regular at Bilderberg, and he apparently a couple of years ago had a bit of a breakdown and decided, look, I can't do this anymore. But his mind has been put back together, his deep mind, and now he's back on the program again. But, you know, a lot of these people are under a lot of pressure to do something which is almost inhuman. That is to say, this particularly the rollout of artificial intelligence taking over from people, robots, that sort of thing. It's something a bit, I suppose, inhuman about it, isn't there? And technology takes over from humans.
Well, I mean, I don't have any specific knowledge about why this person had a breakdown, so it's hard to project anything onto it, because you've no idea why he had one.
What I'm saying is that they're human, these Bilderbergers, and sometimes what they're being persuaded to do as the heads of these big companies is a bit inhuman. Well, anyway, so thanks very much, Martin. We're going to just finish off with a clip from this interview. It's called The Plot to Cancel God. And that's one of the things I think a lot of this history has been about, really, I mean, right the way from the Nazis, right the way through to the Bilderbergers, is getting rid of God. So, and I'll put a link up to the full version of this on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk. So our last clip for the night, the plot to cancel God.
Francis's own words are what we're going to be talking about. Team Francis. Francis says that the Latin Mass movement is ideological, right? But the thing is, he's right about that. It is ideological. It's steeped in the ideology of pro-life, pro-Catholic, pro-family, pro-God-ism, right? And his buddy, Cardinal Arthur Roche, he says that the theology of the church has changed, which it has. This is very exciting news. He says that the theology of the church has changed. Before, says Roche, the priest represented all the people, but he alone was celebrating the Mass. Today, it's not only the priest who celebrates the liturgy, but also all those baptized people in the church. Exactly right, Eminence. Lex orandi, lex credendi. Vatican II changed how Catholics worship in order to change how Catholics believe. And did it work? Well, it depends if you're a modernist or not. From their point of view, to destroy the church, it seems to have worked brilliantly. Right? Just look at that long blue line on your screen, plummeting down, down, down. Cardinal Roche is right. Cardinal Roche is also right when he says that the traditional Latin Mass movement undermines the revolution of Vatican II.
So Francis was very clear in the letter that he wrote to all the bishops when he introduced these changes. And it was very simple that effectively that this has become a movement undermining the Second Vatican Council.
So I'm only half kidding. At the Catholic Identity Conference this year, we will present statements of full-on agreement with what Team Francis is saying. It is a new religion, isn't it? They have created a new religion. And tradition, Catholic tradition, stands directly in the path of that religion, which is why they're trying to get rid of it. It always has. Tradition has always stood in the path of modernism and novelty, hasn't it? It stood in the way, for example, of revolution in 16th century England, didn't it? When the English Catholic men of Cornwall, Devon, and Dorset rebelled against the Act of Uniformity, which was also about unifying the realm, right? They stood against that act in the Western Uprising.
The Western Rebellion of 1549, otherwise known as the Prayer Book Rebellion, was the first serious rebellion in the reign of Edward VI. Now, it originally could have been seen to have originated in Cornwall, where basically there was discontent with the rise of Protestantism following the death of Henry VIII. In Devon, the rising had started due to the locals objecting to the use of the new prayer book, which was incredibly radical, the Book of Common Prayer, and insisted the priests say Mass in the old style, you know, in Latin, etc.
Their battle cry? It's the Mass that matters, right? That's what was on their lips as they died, as they were slaughtered, as they were martyred for the old religion, rather than accept the new order, the Novus Ordo, of Thomas Cranmer. 200 years later, some 500,000 traditional Catholics in the Vendée would do the same thing. 200 years after that, they did the exact same thing. They stood for altar and throne against a Novus Ordo.
Outlaw priests offered outlawed masses in the woods of the Vendée under the cover of night. They gave their lives rather than betray the church during a reign of terror which saw Catholic kings, queens, priests, and nuns slaughtered in the streets of Paris. The Vendeans were the original guardians of tradition, and their flags were emblazoned with the Sacred Heart of Jesus because Saint Louis-Marie Grignion de Montfort had planted the faith so deeply in the Vendée that some 500,000 Catholics fought and died for it.
Oh, you see what we're getting at? You can pick your favorite revolution, anti-Catholic revolution. It's always the same thing. What stands in the way? Tradition stands in the way. Down in Mexico in the 1920s, not that long ago, when once again traditional Catholics stood in the way. We're talking about the Cristeros. They stood in the way of a Masonic revolution against Catholic tradition.
This threat will not be tolerated.
Would they really kick out an old man like me?
The Federalists are coming!
They're coming!
Does that look familiar?
There will
It's the same today, same revolution, only now we got modernists bulldozing sanctuaries, right? Modernists inside the church, smashing up the altars and the statues. It's the modernist revolution, carrying on the same revolution, the same Masonic revolution against Christ Church that's been going on for a long, long time.
Well, obviously, that's all from a Catholic perspective. Doesn't really mention the Orthodox Church there, which is one of the things I think this is all about. I talk about that a bit in the longer piece with Patrick Henningsen, which I'll be putting up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But most definitely, the plot to cancel God goes on. So time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican and Labour activist Martin Summers. Thanks for all those that came over to the Bilderberg Conference and in order to keep a check on the global elite and the NATO lobby. And also thanks to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Do send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics show page, where you'll also find a podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page at thisweek.org.uk. My book about the Bilderbergers is called The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group, which I talk about also on the podcast. And as I say on there, I was approached in 1998 by Roger Van Zwanenburg from Pluto Press to write a book about Bilderberg. But I had lunch with him and I said, look, sorry, Roger, I just don't know enough about it. And with the advent of Dave Barnby, who died last week, or week before last, actually, he put together some little bits and pieces for me, and it was fascinating because I understood then why it was called the Bilderberg Group and the links back to this battle in the Second World War. Anyway, that's what the book's all about. That's The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderbergers. So that's available via bilderberg.org and also on eBay. So this show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and over Sunday breakfast at camberleysradioquk.com. Do please feel free to make live recordings. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. And live on the glorious Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast this show, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable third bank holiday weekend this May. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream at talkradio.org.uk. Next Friday, God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.